and they want to do a little documentary on it and put it on YouTube.
And just one last question. Any more protests planned?
Oh, absolutely. We are going to be there Thursday, and we're calling people out to Thursday to come out. We're also reaching out to elected officials. The demonstration starts at 5:30, and it ends at 6:30 on the dot. It's only 1 hour. We're asking people just 1 hour of their time to come to 66th Street and Columbus Avenue, Lincoln Plaza Square. You know, it's like 1 hour of our time for an eternity of pride in our community.
Julio Pabon is with Boricuas for A Positive Image. He was interviewed by WBAI's Jose Santiago. On Friday, January 20th, there will be protests in more than 110 cities around the country to mark the second anniversary of the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling, giving corporations the right to pump unlimited amounts of money into election campaigns. Here in New York City, the event was scheduled to take place outside the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Courthouse at 500 Pearl Street between 5 and 5:45 p.m., and be followed by a march and rally at Foley Square. But the NYPD has denied a permit for that event. That decision is being appealed, but in the meantime, organizers have tentatively changed the gathering site to Zuccotti Park. David Cobb is a spokesperson for the Move to Amend Coalition, a grassroots movement seeking to overturn the Citizens United ruling. He calls that ruling the latest example of the corrosive doctrines of corporate personhood and money as speech.
So we are launching an Occupy the Courts action on that date because the courts are the scene of the crime. The U.S. Supreme Court created this illegitimate, unconstitutional legal doctrine, and that the federal district courts have been applying them. So we're going directly to federal district courts in order to rally, in order to demonstrate, in order to help build this movement. We're also using that as an opportunity to launch the second phase of our campaign, which is over 50 communities passing ballot initiatives calling to amend the Constitution. Not just resolutions where our elected representatives, but where we are instructing our elected representatives to do it. We're broadening this movement and deepening this movement.
There is a lot of pressure on to repeal this Supreme Court ruling. What is the status of that? How are things progressing at this point?
Well, the movement is getting larger, stronger, and better organized every day. I want to encourage WBAI listeners, please go to the website at movetoamend.org and join this movement because it really is part of a long-term campaign. We are going to amend the Constitution, not just to get money out of elections, which we will do, but even deeper, we're going to abolish completely the idea that a corporation is a person with constitutional rights. I don't want corporations overturn environmental protection laws, public health laws, worker protection laws, any more than I want them able to overturn campaign finance laws.
There are several bills that have been introduced in Congress to do just this, to create a constitutional amendment to overturn this ruling. Is there a particular bill that is being supported, or where are the efforts in that realm at this point?
If you go to the website movetoamend.org, you'll see our proposed amendment. It is the only one that abolishes all corporate constitutional rights and establishes clearly that money is not speech. We are happy to see so much activity at Congress finally on the issue of corporate power, but the reality is that none of them go far enough. So we appreciate the beginning steps, but we are only in the beginning of this movement, and we will not support any effort that does not actually do what it needs to do, which is to abolish all corporate constitutional rights and establish that money is not speech.
What will be happening beyond this Friday and the Occupy the Courts Day?
Again, we will be launching ballot initiatives across the country to allow voters to vote on their position on whether we should amend the Constitution to abolish corporate personhood and get money out of elections. City resolutions passed by elected representatives are great, but we want to go further. We want to go deeper. We want to put it directly to the American people because we know that the American people, regardless of political ideology, are with us.
David Cobb is a spokesperson for the Move to Amend Coalition. Again, the January 20th Occupy the Courts event in New York City will begin at 5 p.m. in Zuccotti Park at the corner of Broadway and Liberty Streets in Lower Manhattan. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, January 18th, 2012. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago, Christine Black, and Antoinette Smith. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.
Welcome to Hour of the Wolf with the wonderful strains of the theme, or one of the themes from Silent Running. And this is Margot Adler. I'm along with Jim Freund, and we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of Hour of the Wolf.
Good morning.
First of all, we want to thank Robert Knight, who gave up some of his time,
all of his time,
so that we could start this at midnight and not at 1:30 in the morning or whenever you start this.
Yeah, 1:30.
At 1:30 in the morning. And so we want to give a big shout out and thank him very much. And here we are. I'm returning to what was the best job of my life. There's no question in my mind that this was the most wonderful thing I ever did, doing this show. And let me start by just telling a little bit about how it all came to be, which was in 1972, 40 years ago. I'm Margot Adler, and I had come to BAI, to WBAI, in 1968. And I started out as a newscaster. And I did the 11:30 newscast, and then I went and ran their Washington Bureau for 8 months until I couldn't stand it anymore. And somewhere around the time, then I came back and I was a public affairs producer and some other things. And somewhere covered the Black Panther bomb conspiracy trial, did a lot of the kind of newsy things. And somewhere while I was in Washington, I'm not exactly sure, you know, time has a weird way 40 years ago of sort of mixing and mashing and doing weird things. But somewhere I read a column by Russell Baker. And that column by Russell Baker said, I don't exactly remember its exact words, but the basic gist of it was this, that, you know, there'll always be an earthquake, and there'll always be a coup, and there'll always be, you know, I don't know. Anyway, you know, who's going to remember your congressman in 50 years? But an archaeological find, a scientific discovery, stories that are more eternal, let's put it that way, are much more interesting. And I went, yes, I was so sick of news, which is an interesting thing to say since I'm still in the news business. But I was really sick of it and I wanted to do something else. But at that time at WBAI, there were very few women who were doing shows that were what we might call free forum live radio, which was being spearheaded by Bob Fass and by Steve Post and by Larry Josephson and later by Paul Gorman. And there were the only
Julius Lester.
And Julius Lester. And the only women who were doing this was Mickey Waldman, Liza Cowan. That was basically.
And Carol Rettner.
And Carol Rettner, yes. But when did Carol Rettner begin? I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Yeah. But I mean, the live radio that we're talking about, very personal. I mean, Liza was doing it as the first lesbian women's show. And Mickey had her own way of being.
Mickey came a little later, didn't
Mickey
she?
Mickey came later. Yeah, you're right. So it was really Liza Cowan was the real, I think, the real groundbreaker of all of this.
Was Electra Rewired her show?
I think so, yeah. So. So I remember feeling that I wanted to do live radio. And I even had the fantasy. I even had that theme song in my mind, you know, when I saw Silent Running or where I saw the album or whatever.
Well, you and I were together when you saw it, when you found the album. We were in the 69-cent shop.
Were we really?
We were.
I don't remember this at all.
Yeah, I remember exactly which bin it was in.
Well, what I do remember was that I didn't have the chutzpah. I didn't have the guts to just go up to the program director, which was Goodman. I mean, the station manager was Goodman at the time, I think. Yeah, right. I don't even remember who was the program director at the time.
This is before Nanette Reynon, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was a man. I'm sure it was a man.
Yeah.
And I didn't have
Cutner?
The chutzpah. No, I didn't have the chutzpah to go up to whoever it was and sort of say, I believe in myself. Give me a show. I'm really wonderful. Because way down deep, I didn't know. You know, I had no idea if I could do this. And I wasn't sure of myself. And also, I didn't really feel I had the right. So I went. But I've always been what I would call a creative oozer. You know, you're standing in a line. It's a very New York thing to do. You're standing in a line. And suddenly, you're three people ahead, but you didn't move. There's so, you know, it's sort of like you go in the little spaces and you're just suddenly standing there and you're suddenly just a little ahead.
You didn't cut in line.
I oozed, right? So I've always been a very creative oozer. And so I went up to whoever it was, Goodman or whoever it was, and I said, you know, Larry Josephson comes in the morning at around, you know, 7 o'clock and Bob Fass, the way it worked was Bob Fass could go off the air anytime he wanted.
Anytime after 3.
Yes, but he would, you know, often it was 5, sometimes it was 4:30, sometimes it was 4:45, and then the station would be dark, and at 7 o'clock, Larry Josephson would come in and do his show. And so I said, no one's using pretty much 5 to 7.
In those days, we turned off the transmitter.
We actually turned it
off.
We were not a 24-hour station. And I said, give them to me. And I even said, fire me. Because I was, at that point, a public affairs producer and an announcer. I said, fire me. I'll go on unemployment. And I will start this show. And if you like it, you can hire me back. And that's how the show started. And the show was not originally a science fiction show. It was a kind of everything show, but there was a kind of, I would say it was a mixture of feminism, spirituality, pagan spirituality, science fiction, environmental stuff, politics or whatever. It was that. And so there'd be everything. There'd be, you know, palm readers would come on and authors would come on and environmental people would come on and a lot of feminists would come on and science fiction writers would troop on. And so it was all those different things. And there were also phone calls. But the most wonderful thing about it was that we created an incredible community at 5 a.m. There was this sense that someone could call up and almost take the show where they wanted, and it could become a completely different thing than anything you ever thought or were trying to do. So, for example, I'll give a few examples. So, you know, one day a cab driver called and just took over the whole show and just started talking about the what goes on when you drive a cab and what his experiences were and so forth. And one day I went on the air. I'll never forget this. This story I think I told 14 months ago when we did this before. One day I went on the air and just said, you know, I'm 20, whatever I was, and I'm really scared to have kids. I'm not sure if I'm ever going to have a kid because I'm an only child and I think I'd break it. and not only do I think I'd break it or him or her, but I think way down deep, I only allow myself to be a rebel because I'm alone. And if I had a kid, I'd be a Stepford wife. I'd become such a Stepford wife. I just, you know, I'd be such a conformist because I'd want my kid to prosper and all those things that I've opted out of, like not having to be part of the PTA or this, you know, I just succumb totally to the values of the culture and everything if I had a kid. And I just went on like this, you know, and I never changed a diaper and I don't know what to do. And I, you know, I just screamed, you know, I just said all this stuff for like a half an hour and then took phone calls, you know, and people, it went on for a week every night. Mm-hmm. It went on for a week because people called up with the babies crying in the background and and said this was the best
especially
decision,
at 5 a.m. Yeah,
the best decision they'd ever made in their life or the worst decision they'd ever made in their life. And people wrote me 10-page single spaced letters which I read on the air, and then we opened the phone lines. And and it was just, the whole show was like that. You know, the whole show had this personal quality. I remember one day I had a woman on who had an essay called The Asexual Manifesto.
Ah, yes.
Remember that? And
I remember
she,
it very remember, well.
Right? And she went on saying, you know, that there was a kind of dictatorial quality in this culture that you had to be sexual. And she really wanted to put out the possibility that you didn't. And a lot of interesting people called up. And it was a really fascinating, absolutely fascinating show. There was one day that we did a, I guess it was an anniversary of the moon launch.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, 69, the big Apollo moon launch, and Armstrong and everybody on the moon. And we did this incredible anniversary, which included this recording that, the music person, the woman who was the head of our music, did all these, she does recordings now. She's
Judy Sherman.
I don't know if it was Judy Sherman had this or if she'd done this or if this was a friend of hers, but it was a moon launch where you heard the countdown and the rocket, and then you heard a woman scream because, remember this? Because
yes,
it was like the rape of the moon, like the
right.
moon was the goddess and it was the rape of the moon. It was this really incredible.
It was a friend of hers, and damn it, his name just would
it was
have
a guy?
Been, would have it was a guy, as I recall.
Wow.
It was a guy who she worked with,
right.
as I recall, if I have that correctly. I think it was a fellow by the name of Mike Lobel. I could mm-hmm. be wrong about
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm.
But she broadcast a number of things, and he went on to be some kind of a major producer. But he did a couple of things for us, including a half-hour piece called It Goes Without Saying That. Yeah, with, you know, a lot of clever, exceedingly clever, funny, intellectual music, sound jet kind of things. And I think that may have been his work, but I hope I'm attributing this correctly.
So we did just these incredibly experimental shows, and because it was 5 a.m, you could kind of get away with almost anything. You know, you could even do things that we would now think are slightly illegal, like you could play copyright material that you weren't necessarily, but at 5 a.m, who cared, you know? You could do a lot of really weird things that maybe now you couldn't do as easily.
Mm-hmm.
And you certainly couldn't do at 5 p.m. And there was this sense that people were willing to talk deeply, personally, emotionally, in a way that they were not able to do at 2 p.m, and that this was a safe communitarian space for that. And the, you know, and maybe there were 50,000 people listening total, 40,000 people listening, 30,000 people listening, 20, who knows what there were. But remember, at that point, WBAI had a huge listening audience. There were 500,000 people listening to the war summary.
Yeah.
Every night. And yeah.
People today do not get how many people we used to have in our listening audience.
That's
right. They can't begin to imagine.
Right. So let's say there were
think we make it up when we tell them.
So let's say there were 30, 40,000 people listening, but the quality of those listeners and the engagement and the letters that they would write, and a story that I tell everybody, I says, you know, I can do a piece on All Things Considered or Morning Edition now, and it's a good chance 2 million people are listening. But if I get 2 or 3 comments at all, and sometimes it'll just be, you made this grammatical error, or you pronounced Beijing wrong or something like that. Whereas the engagement of these listeners, I mean, I have boxes of letters, and they're just searing. They're just beautiful. And so I think that something was created not only by me, but by all the people who did live radio in those days that is not, you know, it's not happening really anywhere.
Well, there were a few factors that were involved. Number one was you. Number one was nobody has, you say it was the best job you ever had, and I say it was some of the best radio WBAI ever had, because you were bringing this totally different concept to the sandbox, to the place where people could play and do things, not just because you were a woman in there, but also because you were a journalist, because you had this mindset, because you had the background of somebody who came out of Berkeley, then the free speech movement, that you came out of the news department, but you also came out of a place where, yes, we could do science fiction. Yes, we could discuss these amazing things, and you could discover, because this is the era in which you were discovering neo-paganism.
That's true. It was exactly at the same time that I was discovering paganism and also playing with realities. I mean, we did the famous Holy Hologram show, and this was just at
the
beginning.
The more Piglet looked.
Yeah, the more Piglet looked, the more Piglet wasn't there. But
the more Pooh looked, the more Piglet wasn't there. That was
exactly.
It, yes.
Exactly. And
Eugene Dolgoff.
Or maybe it was more the more Piglet looked, the more Pooh wasn't there. No, you're right. I forgot.
But it was Dr. Eugene Dolgoff.
That's right. And this was at the very early. I mean, now we don't think anything about holograms. They're all over the place. But at that time, it was really
cutting
edge.
And actually, white light holograms, you don't see them as readily as you did then.
Right.
In fact, it's sort of like, you know, ebbed again in
and
a way.
So he came on and did this completely, you know. When you think that this was, you know, 30 years before The Matrix, there was a certain Matrix quality about
well,
about
and,
the kind
and
of
he
stuff.
He was talking about the kind of stuff where you would create a hologram, and that the hologram itself, the existence of the hologram, could make the thing solid, could become reality.
Right.
Now, and that was a bit far out there, but on the other hand, now we have 3D printers. We have printers that will allow you to make something plastic out of a printer that you construct in a computer.
Right.
And it comes out in a printer. So it's really, that's even perhaps more far-fetched than some of the concepts.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just that you found a new place, a new time, a new way of thinking at a time of day when really nobody else was thinking. It wasn't only that WBAI wasn't on the air 24 hours a day, but there wasn't anything else at 5 a.m. worthy of tuning into.
There was rock music, basically.
There was maybe rock music and news radio, and that was it. There was nothing else, no sports shows, no content of any kind. And we are in that interstitial space between the 60s and the 70s, which is a very magical time in the era of humanity. And so we were all of the right age. The listeners were of the right type. WBAI was in the right place. And all of these things came together in so many ways. But chief among it was you.
Oh.
And I knew it, damn it. You know, I was your chief acolyte. I was there for every show.
Right.
Even if
right.
I wasn't engineering, and I engineered a lot of the shows. If I wasn't doing that, I was giving you a back rub. right? I was there pretty much every day. And which is how eventually the Thursdays and Fridays became the science fiction shows, partly because of my involvement, and you weren't sure about me to begin with.
Right, and then I gave up Friday. That was the first thing I gave
yes.
up, was for the Friday show.
Yeah, which I did.
Yeah, right.
And you then co-hosted Mondays occasionally with different people who were around the station, like Mike Hodel, before he went out to L.A., and Neil Conan, mm-hmm. who came on just to do a show. You and he did a show about Heinlein that I remember so well. I'm feeling very jealous about. It's like, I was actually at home listening. And it's like, they're discussing science fiction on Hour of the Wolf, and I'm not there.
Oh, that's funny.
I was
that's
very funny. Jealous.
It was quite an amazing time. And then eventually, I'm still not sure why I decided to do a show at a different time. I don't even
remember. I know exactly why.
Why did I do that?
You went to Clarion.
Yeah.
And when you went to Clarion, I took over the program.
Mm-hmm.
And when you came back, you were immediately in discussion with the powers that be for Unstuck in Time, for another time slot. I think they approached you and you were quite willing to hear what they had to say about it. And initially that was 7 to 9 a.m.
Right.
And I could continue to engineer. So right. I'd be on 5 to
and
7, you'd be on 7 to 9.
And then it became an afternoon show.
Then became an afternoon show and then a Monday night show.
Well, that was it. They only became a Monday night show because I had a kid in 1990.
That's right.
After all my protestations about never having a child.
Yes, you were talking all about them. I wonder, you know, is Alex, your 21-year-old, listening?
No, I'm sure he's not.
Did you break him? Did you drop him and break him at any time?
No,
I don't think so. He looked old to me when I saw him earlier.
But that's
tonight.
A whole other story. If someone wants to, you know, ask me that question when we take phone calls, we can do that.
Yeah.
But
and the calls are already coming in.
Oh, yeah. Right. But it was just, it was a magical time.
It was, exactly. It was an extremely magical time. I think
you could do it today in that same way. I really do think that people, except the only trouble is that people now are so used to a certain kind of horrid, disgusting type of talk show. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they're so used to, whether it be on the right or the left, the Rush Limbaugh, the whatever, the people, you know, where you go on and you just want a strident point of view and you want to sort of say what your two cents is, and then someone else contradicts you and then you shout back and so forth and so on. Well, so the idea of a show that
A lot of those shows existed then. There was Alan Burke and Joe Pine.
That's true.
You know, before there was Rush Limbaugh and all these horrid, horrid people who were on the radio on either end of the spectrum.
Right.
Their hate radio on either end.
But I think
they existed then as well.
I guess they did. I guess they did. It was just that I think it was rare. I think it was.
But they weren't early in the morning.
I think it was rare. I think WBAI was one of the only places, when you think about Steve Post and you think about Larry and you think about Bob Fass, was one of the only places that began to think that what was supposed to go on the air wasn't clear and factual, that it was supposed to be created in process, that it was supposed to evolve, that the show wasn't formatted in a certain way, that it was something that evolved partly from the host, but also partly from the community, and that what happened between the community and the host was always changing, always evolving, and ended up in places that you might never have imagined.
And today, people still do not understand that or get that fully. Fass obviously still does it. Radio Unnameable is still Radio Unnameable. Bless it. I occasionally, especially, well, you know, it was only for up until 14 months ago that Hour of the Wolf was on only one day a week. And therefore, because it was on only one day a week, I turned it totally into the science fiction program. But that's not because I didn't like the breadth. But, of course, I've never had the news background or the wide area of interest that you've had. So given only 2 hours a week, I did the one topic on which I am truly expert. But even there, I refused to format the show totally. And even today, I refuse to totally format the time slot in which I am. I must say, however, that I still treasure that 5 to 7 a.m. time slot. It's a very, very special time slot. And it has something to do with Vargteamen, the Hour of the Wolf. I saw Veronica Shaness earlier tonight. I hardly got to say hello to her, but she's a professor of mythology and stuff in the CUNY system somewhere. And one time I was explaining something to her, and I said, well, the concept of Hour of the Wolf, she said, what are you telling me about? It's Vargteamen. She didn't even know about the Ingmar Bergman film. She just knew of the concept, the premise of what Vargteamen, the wolf time, or Hour of the Wolf, is all about this time, this magical time of day in which children are born, in which they die, in which dreams are effective, and all of this important magical stuff going on, which is what Ingmar Bergman made the movie about, from which you took the title. And something that I've only realized in recent years is that, of course, in Sweden, in the far northern places where Vargteamen is a part of the way of thinking, the twilight, the morning twilight, can be hours long. You know, because it's just that part of the world. Twilight can be 3 hours.
Right.
That time between night and dawn, which is how it is defined. And by the way, I have to do this rant every so often. On Babylon 5, there was an episode called Hour of the Wolf. And all these people, including a punk rock band and all these different people, call themselves Hour of the Wolf. And they don't know what it is. They have no concept of what Hour of the Wolf is actually supposed to be. They just see it as this dark, demonic kind of a thing and all that because J. Michael Straczynski wrote it into a script of this popular, occasionally very good and occasionally not so great television show. And so people have this other definition, Well, Bergman got it from the Swedish myth, and he expresses it well, which is one of the reasons I occasionally like to play the trailer from that movie, because it defines the concept as defined in the movie. But that's part of it, is that that interstitial time between night and dawn, it is so amazing. It is so magical. And we would go into the station, which at the time was in the church, in an inner sanctum within this deconsecrated church. And the show began without question at night. And it ended without question with the sun in the sky. That whenever the daylight occurred, whenever that change occurred in New York City, at least, it occurred during that show. It might be more toward the beginning and more toward the end, but it was always there. And that, too, had something to do with this special place created.
I also think that the other thing about it was that people were just willing to say things because of that time that they would not be willing to say.
Starting with you.
Well, yes, partly yes, starting with me. Yes, I was willing to say some things that probably, if these tapes exist, would probably be very embarrassing right now, as a matter of fact. I was willing to be very personal in ways that probably I shouldn't have been. But that was modeling. That was a kind of modeling for people, for other people to say things that they might not normally have said. And that's exactly what it was. And people were willing to just talk in a way that I think it's very hard for them to. People just, it's very, very rare that you see that. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm part of this coffee group. It's a long story. It's a whole other story. But I'm part of this coffee group that I go to almost every weekday before I go to work. And one day, someone in the group, who will be nameless at this moment, I was saying something fairly personal, and they said, TMI, TMI, as in too much information.
Oh.
And I suddenly realized that this whole notion of TMI, of too much information, is a total anathema. It's totally against anything that I basically believed, either as a journalist or as a person who would have been doing a show like this, that there was no such thing as too much information. And that the notion in our culture that we would put up a barrier to someone's personal story as too much information shows, I think, a fear of that, of learning about that kind of
that intimacy,
that depth, that whatever it is, that whole notion of TMI is really problematic.
I recall well you and I being out at the all night diner by the corner of the station, and you told me very specifically, this happened more than once, but one that sticks to mind specifically involved a member of the New York Mets.
Oh yes.
And you were saying, Freund, if you tell anybody this, you tell anybody what I am about to tell you, our friendship is over. We cannot, you know, I will not be able to talk to you because you cannot share this. And you went on to tell me all these amazing, wonderful, deep, intimate.
And then I
thoughts.
Probably said it on the air.
And then, yeah, at 5 a.m., at 5:01, on the air, all the stuff they had sworn me to secrecy about, you're just blabbing it out at 99.5 million times every second over the frequencies of New York frequency modulation, you know?
And to give you the 1 minute version of this story, because we're not going to go on, is that I had a complete crush on Bill Lee, the spaceman.
No, Tom Seaver. This is before Bill Lee.
There was nothing with Tom Seaver.
When he was rebelling. It was both of them to an extent.
No. This is the personal story is all about Bill Lee.
The Spaceman, who I eventually had on the show.
Yes. So the story is that I had this big crush on Bill Lee, and Bill Lee was the Spaceman, and he was a pitcher first for Boston, then he got traded to Montreal.
The ultimate southpaw.
And he was famous for saying things like he really loved to put a little marijuana on his pancakes, and that any really great pitcher would, like some Tibetan priest, make the ball appear, disappear, and reappear in the catcher's glove.
Yeah.
And he would say really wonderful things like that. And I just, I thought he was wonderful.
He tried to be instrumental in causing the Boston Red Sox, at a point when they were for sale, to actually buying themselves and becoming a co-op and becoming a communist thing. He went to China to teach baseball. And he's
did
an amazing
all kinds
man.
Of all kinds of odd end things. So at one point, I first met him when he was being traded to Montreal, and I went up and did a piece for NPR, which actually still is somewhere on file somewhere. And it was a wonderful experience, and he was, you know, he had all these fantasies about how he was going to grow mushrooms. It was a completely crazy interview, et cetera. And then years later, he was traded to Montreal, and I met this woman who was a friend of a friend who was what we might call a baseball Annie. And she had season tickets. And she invited me to a Mets game. And at one point, she said that one point this woman had a relationship with a Montreal player, a African-American Montreal player whose name completely escapes me. And she said, you know, I'm going to go back to, you know, I'm going to go, he's going to pick me up in the car after the game. Would you like to go with you know, would you like to get Bill Lee to come along? So there I was in the back of the car with Bill Lee, my complete hero, and she's with this guy. And we're in the back of the car. Nothing's happening. You know, it's not like we're making out or anything like that, although I think Bill Lee was passing around a joint. And
he was generally doing that.
Doing that. And then what happened was we got to his hotel, and he left for the hotel. And he went in, and I said goodbye. And then I noticed that on my seat, right next to me, he had left his shorts and his jockstrap.
Oh, my God.
This is the funny part of the story. And here I was going into the hotel after him to try to find him, to give him back his shorts
jockstrap.
And his jockstrap, right? And he's still in the hotel. And the hotel people must think that I'm like the local prostitute or whatever. And he's like sitting at, he's right at the counter still talking to the hotel people. And I give it back to him. So, I mean, nothing happened, you know.
Right.
Nothing happened in this story. But still, it was one of those kind of marvelous moments in the world where, you know, you actually get to sort of be with your crush for a moment and sort of think about it or whatever. It was just one of those funny stories.
But this was after your Seaver crush, because the
I did have a Seaver crush.
You did have a Seaver crush.
But
you
I
wrote
never,
about it in the Soho Weekly News,
I never met him.
No, but you and I went to Philadelphia to watch him pitch his first non-Mets game. And how during some of the WBAI troubles, you wrote this wonderful article about this is the time he was having troubles with the Mets, and we were all having troubles with Pacifica Radio. And you wrote this wonderful piece in the Soho Weekly News about how pitching for WBAI was like pitching for the New York Mets. It was a great piece.
And it had me on a baseball card.
It had you on a baseball card. I have that issue. If you don't have one, that one, that heirloom, I know where that one exists.
That was great.
In my basement. But your original Tom Seaver crush predated that by at least a few years.
No, I went and watched him pitch a couple times. I did have his Tom Seaver crush. But I think that was the kind of crush where if you met him, you probably wouldn't like him, you know?
Uh-huh.
Whereas the Bill Lee one was, I think I'd like him even if I met him, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no.
That was the difference.
Yeah, yeah, and when I finally started doing a sports show in 77... a year that the Red Sox were playing the Yankees in major, major games. And thanks to Danny Schechter, news dissector, I got an interview with Bill Lee, which was an amazing
experience.
It really was. So he only cursed twice.
So what should
on
we
air.
Do? Should we take phone calls? Should we play a piece? Should we play a little piece
Why don't
of
we
music?
Play a piece of music and then take calls?
Shall we play my absolutely outrageous Dom the Bard one, or shall we do something else?
Well, I've got an old Hour of the Wolf song queued up.
Okay.
And as long as it's queued up, why not play that? And then and we can choose other things after that.
Okay.
And then we'll open up the phones and, as in old times, see where it takes us.
Exactly.
So we'll be back.
My father was a rocket man. He often went to Jupiter or Mercury, to Venus or to Mars. My mother and I would watch the sky and wonder if a falling star was a ship becoming ashes with a rocket man inside. My mother and I never went out unless the sky was cloudy or the sun was blotted out, or to escape the pain. We only went out when it rained. My father was a rocket man. He loved the world beyond the world, the sky beyond the sky. And on my mother's face, lonely as the world in space, I could read the silent cry that if my father fell into a star, we must not look upon that star again. My mother and I never went out unless the sky was cloudy or the sun was blotted out. To escape the pain, we only went out when it rained. Tears are often jewel-like. My mother's went unnoticed by my father, for his jewels were the stars. In my father's eyes I knew he had to find, in the sanctity of distance, something brighter than a star. One day they told us the sun had fled, taking him inside. Mother and I never went out unless the sky was cloudy or the sun was blotted out, or to escape the pain. We only went out when it rained.
Tom Rapp, formerly of Pearls Before Swine, from not sure what album that was from. It wasn't from the album Stardancer. Stardancer and that song, The Rocket Man, which is so clearly, obviously, based on the short story Kaleidoscope by Ray Bradbury, were Hour of the Wolf stalwarts. There were a few songs, aside from Steel I Span, that were standard songs from Hour of the Wolf. And there was, of course, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Absolutely.
Was a major one.
There was Life on Mars by David
Bowie. Absolutely. I made a TV series out of that
right.
song. Not a bad one. Have you ever? And then there was an American series, a remake of the British series.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some other Bowie as well,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I think Bowie in his Mars.
In his science fictional mode.
In science fiction mode. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. And Yeah, I was the one who brought in Steel Eye Span as an outro. Sales of Silver. That was my doing. You brought in the Space Fleet from Peter Schickele from Silent Running. Was the original.
Right.
Music and intro. This is, by the way, WBAI in New York City.
99.5.
Listener sponsored, non-commercial.
Hour of the Wolf.
Radio. And Hour of the Wolf in, not in its Hour Wolfy Vargteemingly time slot, but certainly in its personnel makeup.
And also in its night part.
In its night part, absolutely. And largely thanks, by the way, again to Robert Knight, speaking of night, nightly nights, for Robert for a second time in a year, in fact, giving up his time slot so that I could, stretch my elbows a little. It was very kind of him and very nice.
Now, I've never seen, when I was here, they didn't have this green light.
I know.
What is that? Is that a phone?
It's an on-the-air light. It is, I think, there's this light that, it's got green, yellow, and red. I have no idea what function it is supposed to, an on-air light is usually good enough, but this flashes on and off, and I find
it's like a lighthouse.
It's like a lighthouse. It is, I find it thoroughly obnoxious.
Right.
To me, it serves no purpose.
But we should take some calls.
We should take some calls at 212-209-2900. And unlike the rules of my other Hours of the Wolf, this time there is no off-topic thing, more or less.
Although we might just say, well, we don't really want to talk about that.
Yes,
so,
and
goodbye.
Yeah, exactly. let's just take some at random. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Yes, hello? you're on now.
Hi. Thank you so much. I want to, first of all, thank you so much for your contribution to WBAI and the culture at large, both you and Margot. I remember you from years and years ago. I first listened to BAI or came across it in 1965.
Wow. That's far back.
Yeah. I was tuning through the dial and I came across Bob Fast, and I first heard Bob Dylan. Right. And I have since traveled along a lot of different places and didn't understand how much BII meant to me until I came back here, because there was nothing out there in any other place that had the authenticity and the spontaneity and the political and social awareness that BII has.
And did you find that true when you listened to other Pacifica stations as well, or did you ever do that?
No, I had never heard any other Pacifica stations. The closest that I came to was when I was living in Seattle.
K-Boo.
And there was a station called KRAB.
Oh, yeah, KRAB,
the,
yes.
The Crab Nebula.
Right, and we had, there was some contention around there, and I had just, I was sort of like, not an intern, but I was the somebody who was guided through this thing by a couple of serious study and professional journalists who were uncompromising. And there was that, that sort of contradiction that exists between commercialism and authenticity.
Mm-hmm. Right? Can I ask you what do you do in the world, or what did you do in the world, or what kinds of things are you doing in the world?
Would you repeat that, please?
Yeah, I was just wondering what kind of, you said you traveled a lot and been all over the kind of places. I was just kind of wondering what kind of work or effort or stuff like that you were doing over the years.
Oh, I've done everything from being a paid sailboat or somebody who sailed and I've mountaineered. I've done a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
I've traveled around. But to me, the important thing is to be authentic to what's real.
Uh-huh.
You know, and there are a few outlets that there are a few, what would you call them?
Oh, there are a few places where it's really possible to sort of be just yourself and not sort of put on kind of
Not just that, but there are a few places where, like, the common spaces are shrinking. Right?
The communal stations, you mean?
Exactly. They're being shrunken and shrunken and privatized and privatized.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And DAI represents that space that's common.
Mm-hmm. I get it.
And that belongs to everybody.
Well, thank you so much. I think that we will go on because we have a lot of callers. But thank you so much for calling and saying that.
Thank you for doing what you have done for decades and decades.
Well,
I remember the first being with Bob Bass, right? You remember
uh-huh.
that?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember Thule Kupferberg. I remember all those people who have contributed so much and who have left. But how would you say?
They left their mark.
Their legacy is with us.
Yep. I remember the first time I heard Howl. What? Oh, my God. I remember having a recording of it, of Allen Ginsberg reading it and playing certain parts of it over and over and over.
Something? I remember a couple of things visiting the DAI. There was a fundraising, and people weren't contributing. So somebody, I don't remember if it was Larry Josephson or who else.
Doesn't matter.
They were playing God Bless America.
That was Steve Post.
Yeah, okay, yes. And he was going to keep playing it over and over and over again. Until somebody...
He still does that, but he does it with the Pachelbel canon now.
Well, and the other thing that I will still never forget... And
Josephson
really
did that too, though.
Yeah, and we really should go on to another call, but take care.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
And I just want to say the other thing, of course, that we always have mentioned is the famous Charles Pitts 2-hour version of Rocket Man.
Yes.
Which?
Well, actually, yeah, it was Mike Edel who cut
Mike
that.
Edel
with,
who cut
but,
that?
But,
right,
but,
right.
But it was
Charles
Charlie
Pitt
who played it.
Yes.
And where people were calling up and thinking that there was something wrong.
And it was
just the end of the song.
Just that, you know, it'll be a long, long time.
And I think it's going to be a long, long time.
2 hours of it.
It was
and
wonderful.
It's going to be a long, long. It was like a meditation. You could sort of get into it. It was kind of like a mantra.
It was really great. It was
and it's
really
going
great.
To be a long, long time.
And part of the secret behind that as well was that during part of that time, I think like the second time we did that, Mike Edel was doing transmitter maintenance and was really good to not have anything broadcasting but to have that over the air. And I just sat in the control room and answered the calls from people. I know, what's going on? Well, we're playing this. Is everything okay? As a matter of fact, it's just fine. Thank you.
Let's take another call.
Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning and happy birthday, Margot.
Hi there, Robert. How are you?
Now I'm going to point a couple of things out to you. I'm going to show you how wide-ranging your show was way back in the 70s. And I remember because I was then still teaching and then the academic wars. And I'm not sure what day it was, but you did a show, and I don't know why you picked the subject of trains, railroads. Maybe you'd taken a wonderful trip somewhere, and you threw a question out. Why was the American railroad experience so different than any other, be it Canada, England, Australia, whatever? And you and I had a discussion about railroad folklore. and you had asked, and it was just amazing, just the subjects you covered. You know, railroad, you know, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, you're talking about trains. Okay, longevity, radio longevity. Now, I have to point out that there are radio shows that have been around longer than Hour of the Wolf. There is a show in New York on another station that's been around for about 67 years, that being on NYC, the Folk Festival with Oscar Brand. The longest show that I know of is the Mormon Tabernacle Choir presentation from Temple Square. That's been around since 1924.
Yes, but not with the same people.
No. Oh, obviously.
Oscar Brand, you know, that's just beyond belief.
Beyond belief. But, you know, I don't even know if the programs are... I'm not sure if he's doing tapes or what.
I think a lot of that is tape. Anyway, Bob Sherman is still on.
Oh, he is? Yeah, that's true as a matter of
fact. Not on QXR still, but he's still on the air.
Yeah. Anyway, think about what Hour of the Wolf has witnessed, if you can say the term. It's lived through 8 presidencies, a presidential and a vice presidential resignation, the resignation of a speaker in the House. I don't know if, Margo, if you remember this, but back in the 90s, 96 or 97, there was a speaker of the House named Bob Livingston from Louisiana, and he resigned right on the House floor on a Saturday morning because it was discovered he had not one, not two, but 6 gumadas on the side. And he was leading the impeachment, you know, clamor for Clinton. All the things that Hour of the Wolf has survived and has witnessed in history, I mean, just absolute history, 40 years of history, and it's been around, and all the great stuff that Jim has had, whether it was Harlan Ellison reading his story, Searching for Kadak, which is absolutely hilarious, or whether it was the Council of Elrond that he did every year, or whether it was the Halloween specials he did for Change of Spell in October, or just any of the numerous Susanna Clarke, just all the great authors he's had on, and just the, again, just what Hour of the Wolf has meant. By the way, just one last thing, because I'm sure you have lots of other calls. As I pointed out to the good Mr. Freund on a number of occasions, the term Hour of the Wolf has popped up all over the literary landscape. I have references to it from 17th century Naples in a Neapolitan folktale collection. In ancient Brittany, there are no words for twilight or dawn. The word for twilight is the hour between the dog and the wolf,
mm-hmm.
and for dawn, the hour between the wolf and the dog. And I have at least 6 or 7 or 8 other references outside of Sweden. And it is
including a poem by Jim Morrison.
Really?
Yes. Which predates the Ingmar Bergman film, yeah.
Yes. So it's just, you know, wonderful to wish you, Margot, a happy birthday. As I say, the last time I saw you, you were headed for the Cape. We ran into each other in a bus station in Providence, and then you were headed for a wonderful 2 weeks in Rome with Silvia Poggioli. And so, again, happy birthday, and let's...
And no cruise ships sunk during that trip.
I hope not.
Although we were looking out at the island of Giglio the entire time. It was actually in Tuscany, and her house looks right exactly where you can see that cruise ship. You could see
it ran on the reef?
Yeah. It's right in front. It's exactly, it's the view from her.
Supposedly, the captain of the ship went close to that island so that he could show the ship off. Maybe he was showing it to her.
No. She was on the island. She was on the coast. She's on the mainland. She's on the mainland.
I don't know. I heard that he was waving to his girlfriend or something.
No, that's not it. Anyway, thank you so much, Robert. That was great.
Okay. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to ask a trivia question, but I just wanted to say to Margot also while she's there, it's a nice chance to talk to her. I just wanted to tell you, I love that report that you did on NPR, I guess it was last year sometime, about your grandfather.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that was an amazing story. Amazing.
That was just for people to know that I went to Vienna this summer because my grandfather's ashes had been lost for 74 years.
That was totally unbelievable. Yeah, that could happen to Alfred Adler.
Yeah, well, what happened was he died of a heart attack in Aberdeen, Scotland in 1937. And, of course, given the world in 1937,
right.
Ashes and remains were not the first thing on anybody's mind.
Right.
And, everybody went on with their life. And then finally some students decided to search for it. And It wasn't in Aberdeen. They were in Edinburgh, but it took a long time to find them, and we then had them taken to Vienna, and there was a big ceremony. But it was just an extraordinary, I spent an extraordinary week last summer in Vienna with that. And going.
And your family never knew what had happened?
They knew that he had died of a heart attack, but I don't think it was, I don't think ashes were relevant. You know, I don't think, I think that this was a family that believed in ideas. They were
Even
not
here and now.
Yeah, they weren't going to get the ashes back or this, that, and the other. They, you know, my grandmother was. It was a complicated situation. They had already moved to the United States. You know, people were in different parts of the world. The Aunt Nellie had still not gotten out of Vienna during the Nazis. I mean, there was, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on. And the main thing that was also happening that I think. Which I didn't put in the piece. One of the reasons they think that Alfred had the heart attack is that he was incredibly distraught. I mean, he probably had it for just health reasons.
Where was he living now? Was this in Germany?
No, he was living in the United States already. Oh. He had moved in 35. He had been in Vienna, and he'd moved in 35. But his daughter, his oldest and most beloved daughter, he had four kids, and his oldest daughter was Valentina. And she had moved to Russia. She had moved to Moscow with her husband. And they were killed in the purges, in Stalin's purges. And he didn't know she was dead yet, or maybe she hadn't even died yet, but he knew that she had been put in the gulag. And he was just totally distraught. And there are some people who believe that his health suffered quite a bit because of the distraught, you know, because of knowing that she was in the gulag.
Right.
And probably the attempts to find out where she was, the attempts to rescue her, they even called on Einstein to help write letters to try to get her out of the gulag, to find out where she was. I'm sure that that was so much more on their mind to sort of deal with the living.
Did your grandfather know Einstein personally?
He must have in some way. I don't know how much, because Einstein did write a letter of some sort. So there must have been some. Yeah, there was some.
And prominent New York expatriate.
And I think that there were letters. There are letters, but there were some letters from Einstein to Alfred and Alfred to Einstein. But the real problem was that was none of that was ever going to work, because the truth was that Alfred's wife, Raisa, my grandmother, was very, very close with Trotsky's wife.
Oh.
And so if any of that was known, which it probably was known to the intelligence services in the Soviet Union, probably my Aunt Valentina was tainted with that. And probably nothing that anyone did to try to intervene was going to help in any way.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing story. Thank you for that. But can I ask my trivia question?
Yeah, sure.
Having two science fiction experts here, I'm trying to remember something about The Prisoner. You remember the show The Prisoner, right?
I actually never saw it, so this is up to Jim.
Okay, I certainly do, though.
Okay, Jim. Now, this, you have to help me with this, because I had a dream, and the granddaughter of a psychoanalyst would totally be sympathetic with this, I'm sure. I've been trying to analyze my dream, and there were some references in my dream, I'm sure, to The Prisoner. But one thing I'm trying to remember, there were certain things they used to say to each other. And one of them, of course, was be seeing you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every time you left someone, you said be seeing you. Was there ever a time, or maybe there was an episode that had the title, something like Many Happy Returns?
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
It sounds like the title of an episode.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, but I don't even know why I'd remember that, because I only saw them, I think, twice. They showed it on PBS about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And I saw them, and then I saw them again. But I don't know why that was.
I bet you could Google it.
I was about to do that.
You think so?
Yeah.
You think
well,
it's on YouTube
you keep
or something?
Talking, and I'll Google it. Okay.
Oh
no!
That'd be
well,
great.
I mean, you just Google, you know, episodes of The Prisoner. Right?
Yeah, I guess so. Many, you know, I thought maybe it's an ironic. I thought maybe it was a title, like one of those ironic.
Because
titles.
At one point I was watching something else, which I've been watching, which is the three seasons of Forever Night. Oh. And
this was like 30 years ago on
Canada. It was episode 7.
You're kidding me. There was an episode called Many Happy Returns?
What would we do without Google? I mean, you know, what would we do?
Well, this was actually Wikipedia, but, you know.
Oh yeah. Wait.
The blackout is over.
The blackout is over. Jim, the blackout is over.
Another bit of trivia. Was that his number? Was he number 7?
He's number 6.
Number 6. Oh,
yes.
Right. That I couldn't remember either. Number 6. So there was a title, Many Happy Returns. Do you think it was, does it say there what the synopsis of this of the show was?
I'm sure it does. Let's see.
Was it ironic that he was being
it
returned?
It is an ironic name, of course, because, leaves the village.
So
and
he escapes
only
right.
to discover that, you know, the outside world is right. no different than the gulag that he was in.
Right. Speaking of gulags.
Exactly. In this episode, number 6 awakes to find the village deserted.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Momentarily abandoning his misgivings that the eerily quiet place gives him, he takes a number of pictures before assembling a raft and making his bid for freedom. After spending weeks at sea, he makes it back to London, where Mrs. Butterworth now occupies his old house and drives his Lotus 7.
Back to the house, right?
Yeah, Mrs. Butterworth is intrigued by number 6's plight, feeds him, lends him clothes and her car so that he can make contact with his former employer.
Right.
They are skeptical of his story, et cetera, et cetera.
How does he end up back on the island? I don't remember that.
He gets in touch with the intelligence community. He leads a plane to the village, only to realize the plane is being piloted by a village Confederate. Number 6 is ejected from the plane and is greeted in the village by number 2, who happens to be Mrs. Butterworth. She offers him many happy returns of the day. His taste of freedom was nothing more than a carefully contrived birthday gift.
Wait.
Okay, we got to go. We got to do something else.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay, but there's the answer to your dream. Take care. Have a good morning. And good morning. You're on the radio.
Hello. Well, I'm just listening to you in my other ear.
Yes, and you know, en route, Margo was saying what a good writer you are.
Very kind of Margo.
Is this Terrence?
It is. I had to call in to say hi. I've been listening to you guys.
Yes, I was just in the car on the way here. I was just basically saying what a good writer you were and basically hoping desperately that a publisher was going to buy your third book.
Well, the third book is so different from the first two. It's a whole other terrain. Then I've got to get back to the third vampire novel.
That's what I'm talking
yes,
about.
Yes, I mean, after the whole Christmas thing.
Yeah.
That I'm going back to. But it's very funny.
We should say this is Terrence Taylor, author of some wonderful books like Bite Marks and Blood Pressure. Yes.
Bite Marks and Blood Pressure.
Yes.
But I've been listening to the stories, and with the stories I've been hearing before about the beginning days of The Hour of the Wolf, I'm waiting for the Judd Apatow movie, you know?
Oh, God.
I could just see it now. You know, what's his name from Facebook and play the young Jim? What's his name?
Mark Zuckerberg?
Or better yet, Michael Cera.
Oh, my God. Michael Cera. You know, actually, that could sort of work.
He looks a lot like the young Jim,
There's a similarity. The Scott Pilgrim thing, yeah.
Yeah, the little curly hair, you know, the whole sort of look. You know, I could see him managing to pull it off well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who would play young Margot, though? That's what I'm not sure of. That's really good. Maybe the girl from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, because she sort of seems chameleon-like, and she could, like, grow her hair long.
Rooney Mara, the American or the Swedish?
The American.
Mara.
Yeah, I could see her transforming. I was looking at some early shots of Margot on Jim's site that I Googled and found. It is true. What would we do without Google?
It's amazing.
We were talking about what we were doing before cell phones, and it's like, well, we actually told people where we'd be, and we were there. It's like we didn't play it by ear. We actually made plans, and we committed, and we kept to them. It wasn't like, well, I'll be sort of downtown. I'll give you a buzz, see if you can find me. Social life has got a great game of digital tag now. We just sort of wander the cities and find each other by cell phone. The thing that was interesting, though, is you were talking earlier about how much you had done in the early days of Hour of the Wolf you probably could not do now.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, that's so ironic, but it's so true. That it's the 25th anniversary of The Power of Myth. And they're putting it back on PBS, and they've done, you know, new bumpers with Bill Moyers and everything to introduce it. But days were spent, like, putting blurs over Aboriginal butts.
Really?
You know? And I mean, when I looked at what some of the, you know, but any sort of nudity, the argument was...
Oh, my dear.
I know.
Oh, so wait a minute. Blurs are being put now or
yeah,
then?
Now.
Now.
Stuff that was not blurred 25
well,
years ago.
Well, I actually think that there is...
And I haven't seen all of them, but it's like, you know, it's breasts. But it's like Aboriginal breasts. It's like old black and white Aboriginal, like anthropological footage of manhood rituals. Right? That's what Campbell was talking about. And it's, okay, I understand the argument that, well, they might run this during the day. We don't want children seeing it. But anyone who's popping their kid down in front of the power of myth, I would think, would kind of want to sit with them and explain it to them. So it is, to me, an example of in 25 years, we cannot show freely on public television what was on and praised at the time. It's sort of a shame.
Yeah, well, I actually think this is part of a whole other discussion, which is that there's a little more, what is the word?
Puritanism?
I think there's a little more, I think there's actually more upset and obsession and problems about facing the human body. Hello? You must be off. Oh, well.
I think he lost his Bluetooth.
He lost his Bluetooth. But it doesn't matter because we can just answer this by just saying, thank you, Terrence. That was great. And basically, I think there's a lot of fear about – there's more fear about nudity than – I've noticed that, for example, on the clothes optional beach that I sometimes go to in the summer, there are less people. It's as if there's more – and that's not true of Gunnison Beach in New Jersey, but I think there's more fear about the human body than there even was, certainly in the 60s and 70s. And you'd think that we've come a long way, but I think there is more puritanism of a certain type.
Although in Brooklyn, the Mermaid Parade continues.
Ah, yes. Well,
with a certain amount of nudity.
And there is the naked pants, the subway flash mob pants thing, and the naked cowboy. I just think that people are much more... You know what it is? People are much more, their space, their private space in the United States of America. I'll give you one example. I was in the elevator several years ago in a building, and I heard a fairly well-off, clearly, mom, it doesn't matter where this was, but say that they were moving out because they had they had a boy and a girl, teenagers, and they just didn't think they could share a bathroom. And I thought to myself, that is so bizarre. I grew up in a very nice apartment on Central Park West that had only one bathroom, and everybody shared it, and no one had a problem with it. What is going on in a society? And I think it's partly that there's a lot more wealth, and that lot more wealth has created everybody having their own room, everybody having, you know, certain kinds of space. And it's made people less willing to be close to each other in intimate ways, even in families.
So it's a loss of intimacy overall.
Well, it's not – I'm not talking about personal emotional intimacy, but I'm just – I think that
physical
people are
intimacy.
More – I think space is become – people are more apart in a certain way. They're more unwilling to be in the same – to be close to people in a certain way.
Wow.
I may be wrong about this, but that's just a perception I have.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting one. 212-209-2900 is the number here at WBAI. And good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hello. Are you there?
Okay, we'll move on. And good morning, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, how you doing? I come from Boston, and I came to New York in 1961, and I discovered BAI, and I've been listening to it regularly ever since then. And the thing occurred to me... yeah, your show has been put in this rather awkward period of time. I'm not able to listen to it as easily as I could from the 5 to 7.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing occurred to me: why hasn't BAI gone into using the internet as a way of expanding their programming. So because if you have, because you actually you already are on the internet, but you're just using it in an archival sense rather than doing some, you know, some real programming. And your program would be the ideal type of program to explore that. So why hasn't that even been explored?
It is, right? I mean, you're streaming it, right?
Yeah. Well, it's streamed, and it is, and as the caller said, it's used archivally. But I know what you're talking about, like the DVD extras, as it were. And actually, we did that last week, where we had a 90-minute show, but we had writers analyzing a short story that had been read, and there was over an hour just of the analysis. There was like 64 minutes of that. So that analysis is available actually at ourwolf.com, and you can hear that we only broadcast 10 minutes of it. But the entire hour is available online. I like to think of it as the DVD extra to the show.
Oh, okay.
So, and on the show, we did the part that you cannot do on the internet, which is we took phone calls and we did all the extemporaneous work.
Well, let me ask you a question, Jim, as someone who's completely on the outside and hasn't really spent, I confess, a lot of time listening to BAI recently, because I'm too busy. basically, when I want to listen, let's say, to On the Media, let's say on NPR, which is one of my favorite NPR programs, and I love Brooke Gladstone, and she's a friend, too. I can go into my app on my iPhone or whatever, and I can listen to that program whenever I want. And can I listen to Hour of the Wolf whenever I want?
For 2 weeks.
Ah, but then it disappears.
Yes. Yeah, now, I could. Now, you see, I could, and I have thought about, and I actually have a separate URL for podcasts. I am thinking about this. I have been thinking about this for a long time, and there is ourwolf.org. This is a secret. Not anymore, it isn't. But I will start doing podcasts there. But one of the main differences between NPR and what I do in Hour of the Wolf is very simple. I play music. The music that I play, we do not secure. We have not secured
the
internet copyright for streaming. It's okay. We can stream the music, but the moment that it becomes a podcast, the moment it becomes available on demand that somebody could make a copy of it, the whole legal system changes. So on the media, on All Things Considered, on whatever it is that you hear on NPR, NPR owns the rights to what little music they have.
I see.
Within there. Now, how they do it with, for example, John Schaefer's show on NYC and things like that, I'm not sure. They somehow, they get clearances, but they're doing that with a lot of money. I don't
And they also have these deals with BMI and with other places.
Well, we have deals with BMI and ASCAP, but through the same sources. We get that through CPB. But we do not, but there is not a clear internet definition for doing that. And that's one of the problems.
And the streaming, but people can from outside New York. They can go to the stream, right?
Oh, yes.
How many people are doing that right now?
At this very moment, hold on, for not a heck of a lot, but I can tell you 87 at this very moment. But that's only those who are listening live right now. Now, how many people will hear this show over the next 2 weeks? I'm not sure. I don't get the numbers on that.
Well, you know, the thing is, I think that, you know, that's where the media is going, to the internet. And what better station to explore that than BAI? And so I think people ought to think a lot more about how to use the internet, because your problem has always been, you know, in regular broadcasts, with space, time, and now you no longer have that problem.
Well, yes and no. The problem with the internet is that it's not extemporaneous. We could not be having this phone conversation on the internet.
Oh, Okay.
Not even with Skype or something?
No. How would you broadcast it?
Well,
would
be, well, I mean, well, the thing is,
we could talk together, but who else? But who could hear it?
The thing is, I do public access programs on the cable, and that also in here in New York. That also goes over the internet.
Yeah, well, what about internet radio?
Yeah, exactly.
Internet radio does not take phone calls.
Yes, it does.
Well, yeah, that's
I've been. No, I'm sure it does.
Did we just lose a call again?
I think we lost a call again. But anyway, let's go on to another call. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I don't know how that is done. Yeah, I can tell you that at computer trade shows, when I talk to people representing Radio 360 and various things, they do not have a simple way of having an internet-based show take phone calls.
Huh.
So maybe they're doing some other methodology.
Well, let's go on to a different subject, actually.
Okay, 212-209-2900. Good morning, you're on the radio. Hi there, turn your radio down, please.
All right, I have a question for Margot.
Okay.
Are there other people with your last name who, you know, either are alive or have lived, such as Luther Adler?
Well, what about, are you asking, is he related? Or I'm not sure what you're asking. Oh,
yes.
Okay. So I'll tell you a funny story.
Great.
There are very few Adlers that are related to me in the sense that there's a woman named Amanda Adler in Scotland. There's another woman in Canada. There are very few Adlers that are alive that are related to me. Now, my mother, who was originally named Freda Pasternak and changed her name to Nack, N-A-C-Q-U-E, a long story. You can read all about it at some point in my memoir, Heretic's Heart. But anyway, she ended up being very theatrical. She started something called Saturday Theater for Children in Harlem. She did all this stuff, and she became incredibly friendly with the Adler family that you're talking about. In other words, Luther and Stella and all those people. Yes.
Oh,
so she became, particularly with Stella's two nieces, which were Lulla Adler and Pearl Pearson, and they became two of her closest. Yeah, two of her closest friends.
What a great teacher.
Yes. Oh, Pearl Pearson was amazing,
yes.
Right? Unbelievable. I even took a course with her at the Stella
when
Adler School.
At the 55th
Street. Oh, amazing. So anyway, my mother became very, very close with those people. They were like her best friends. When my son, who's 21, was 2 years old, I was sort of brought to Stella Adler's house and we kind of had this moment where I introduced my son to the great Stella Adler,
yeah.
You know? It was like this amazing moment, but we're not related in any blood sense at all. So I'm not related to those Adlers, but a lot of them walked in and out of my life, or I walked in and out of theirs, yeah. Probably is more accurate to say.
Oh, Pearl Pearson, I adored her. I studied with her for about 2 years.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, absolutely wonderful. I'll tell you the one thing the only thing I remember from that class. She said there was a guy in the class and he was reading a line from Shakespeare, he was reading a little something from Shakespeare, a soliloquy or whatever. And she said, "Don't bring Shakespeare down to you. Bring yourself up to Shakespeare."
Bravo, bravo.
Anyway, let's take another call, thank you.
Bye. Thanks. Bye-bye. 212-209-2900. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Hi.
Hi
there.
I wanted to say that it was Baird Searles that was the one who opened the doors of BAI for you. Baird Searles, he was the director of the programming director.
No, he was the
arts
drama
director.
He was the drama and literature director. I was his intern.
Uh-huh. Wasn't it wonderful? Oh, he was so great. So great.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Another one that we've lost.
Yeah, he lost him quite a while
quite
ago
early.
At this point.
Yeah.
And Martin Last, his lover, died about 4 years ago now.
Yeah. And he was a pioneer. He was a pioneer in gay liberation.
Well, Baird did the very first ever gay broadcasting, electronic transmission of discussion of what he referred to on the air as homosexual issues in 1963.
Right.
Which is the idea of that. I mean, we're talking 49 years ago.
Right.
The idea of his broadcasting about gay issues 49 years ago is simply unheard of, and it was unheard of. He was the very first person ever to do that.
Yep, a saint.
And he was quite something. I worked for him both here at WBAI and at the Science Fiction Shop.
And he also was very instrumental in creating radio drama.
Well, yes. in keeping it alive.
In keeping it alive, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
You know, with you know, he brought to WBAI people such as Joanna Russ, Thomas M. Dish, Samuel R. Delaney, Theodore Sturgeon. He had these people writing for him.
Yeah. Yeah, he was so great. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Take care. Thank you. Bye.
Take care. Thank you. And, okay, well, we'll wait a minute, if you like, for some more calls. What happens is our phone line, aside from the fact that we've heard at least two people be dumped out of our system this morning, is that when people call, it doesn't let them hang on forever. So we can have eight phone calls at once, and then after like 3 or 4 minutes, they sort of cycle off.
And while we're away, we should just say that this is Hour of the Wolf, and this is Margo Adler and Jim Freund, and we are at WBAI-FM at 99.5, and we're having our 40th anniversary celebration by being together. Once again, we are together.
Yeah. And it's always exceedingly special, I must say. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Hello. I'm just calling back as my phone battery had died before.
Oh, is that what happened?
Yeah, I wanted to reassure you that the BAI systems are not completely breaking down and throwing callers offline.
Well, it is, but that's beside the point. And you sound much better now, Terrence.
Oh, yes. Well, it's a landline, and it's not my little phone 20 miles from the base where it's supposed to be.
You're not on the hammock.
There you go. There you go. So, but there you go. But I wanted to call back and just give a good clean closure.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I was at least able to click my radio back on, which I'm one of the streaming listeners right now, and catch the follow-up comments on the call, which was interesting. So that was good.
Very good.
Thank you.
Okay, my dears. Well, again, congratulations again. I mean, my God, 40 years. Jeez.
Yeah, 40 years. Hard to believe.
The other thing is just a fascinating description of the changes in the whole thing over the years from 5 days and 5 a.m. to, like, you know, going through, but, you know, through all that. You know, it's like any other life form. You change or you die.
Yeah. Well, there is a whole history there. There was the point when Margo went to Unstuck in Time, where I had the show for a while for 5 days, but then I gave up 3 of those days, some of it voluntarily, some not so much. Marnie Mueller, our program director at that time, saw to it that I gave up some of that. But I actually was able to hand out some of those time slots to people Joan Hervey and Richard Fioravanti and some other folk. And Gary Fried, of course, had the Saturday and Sunday morning equivalent. And then I had Thursdays and Fridays, and then I was cut down to just Fridays, then to Thursdays, and then I was bumped in 1981 to Saturdays, where I went kicking and screaming, but it turned out to be a great move.
Yeah, right.
So, thank you, Terrence.
Indeed. And did I hear someone earlier wish you a happy birthday?
No. It's the birthday of the show.
Of the show. Okay.
It's an anniversary.
It's an anniversary. It's not a birthday.
Is it multiple events?
No, I was wondering about that myself. It's an anniversary. Yeah. I'm an April person.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah.
13th having its.
I had a birthday, Terrence.
Year, and I keep flipping back and forth of whether we're calling it anniversary or birthday. It's an anniversary.
Right. And I actually spent my birthday with Margo.
Ah, Lolly, that's right. That was recent.
We went to see Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Right. I think I had talked to you as you guys were heading off to that.
That's right.
Yeah. How was that?
Very, very, very good. But if you were like me when I, you know, I had never seen the BBC version.
Or read the novel.
And I had read many, many Le Carré novels, but not that one. So I went on Wikipedia before I came, which was a lucky thing, because if I hadn't, I would have been quite lost.
Oh. So it's sort of like watching David Lynch's Dune. You really kind of have to read the book just to know what the hell he's talking about.
Well, you sort of have to know who are the five suspects to be the mole. And so that you sort of kind of go in there with at least that kind of knowledge.
It's much clearer in the TV version, which Barbara and I just rewatched.
And was what, 5 times longer or something? How long is the TV?
It's 7 hours long.
6 or 7 hours.
7 hours.
And it's apparently great, right? Yeah. It's really great. Well, we should go on and take another call, but thank you.
But again, congrats, and I will talk to you both later.
Very
absolutely.
Good. Take care. Good morning. And good morning. You're on the radio.
One last thing, folks, and I'll make this very quick. Margo, did you know that your last name has become part and parcel of World War II military history?
You mean just the Eagle Adler thing?
Yes. The Germans were going to launch an operation called Sea Lion. It was going to be the invasion of Britain. But before they did that, they were going to try to gain air superiority. And in August 1940, it was August 14, 1940, they launched Operation Adlertag. And that was to destroy not only the RAF Fighter Command, but the RAF airfields and the radar stations along Britain's southern coast. And that might have succeeded, except on the night of August 24th, a group of German bombers got lost and they bombed London by mistake, precipitating a British retaliation on Berlin, and the rest is history, because the next day Hitler ordered Goering to start bombing the German civilian cities, which gave the RAF a chance for breathing space, and as I say, the rest is history.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Dankeschön. Okay, 212-209-2900 to speak with Margot Adler and Jim Freund on Hour of the Wolf. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hi there.
Hi, Jim.
Yeah.
Lori Victoria.
Hello.
Hello, dear. Last time I saw you, I think, was in last May, first time I saw you, last May fundraiser. What a delightful show. Margo, you're a pleasure and a joy. How lovely to have you back. And the two of you have been conducting the most a swamp of nostalgia. It's absolutely delicious. The callers have been delightful. This is the wonderful WBAI as I remember it. And the first time I remember hearing it was, I think, in November 1967. And Bob Fass was on, and all we kept hearing was, you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. And do you remember that famous night? You just kept playing it and playing it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember that night because I was still in Berkeley, but I have played that song so many times. As a matter of fact, it's kind of a Thanksgiving tradition.
Yeah, I'm an old-fashioned folkie.
Yeah.
All right, now, Margo, earlier when you spoke of your feelings towards children, I said, exactly. I'm a half-Jewish only child with a world-famous grand-uncle, equally famous with your grandfather, and is probably the only name of repute, of international repute, ever produced by the Netherlands since William of Orange. He was a world-class professor of Western civilization, wrote the first book of history called The Waning of the Middle Ages, Johann Karl Huizinga, and to consider women's position in late medieval life, and subsequently wrote a book, I don't know if it's translated in English, called Homo Ludens.
Oh,
Playful
Homo
Man.
Ludens is a very, I've read Homo Ludens.
That is my granduncle, Johann Karl Huizinga, and that was the same name as my father. So apparently your grandfather and my granduncle, roughly contemporaneous, and both...
both grand people.
Homo Ludens was about play.
Exactly.
It was about the whole thing, about how man is a playful creature.
Hmm. And I think it was an Aquarius. I'm a quadruple Aquarius. And when is your birthday, dear?
April 16th. I'm an Aries.
Huh?
Aries.
Yeah, I know. I'm one of my favorite flavors.
Right.
No, but I just... And then your whole attitude towards children... was I said, my God, it's exactly the same. And two things you said just, I burst into giggles because you said, I was afraid I might break it. And I said, that's the word. I said, I might drop it. I might do something terrible to the poor kid. And then when you said about the Stepford Wives, well, I was raised a rebel. I was raised by a, my mother had a marvelous job, her own garment factory in L.A., and I'd have somebody to take care of me, and the woman she got for me was a wobbly, International Workers of the World.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I was raised a lefty, a rebel, a feminist, a free, you know, free lover, and all that sort of thing, and... You know, I used to listen to your show way, way back, and it always gave me a jolt of joy when I caught you on NPR or something like that. And the two of you and Jim, the friendship and the warmth, and you used a word I hadn't thought of for so long, but it's the exact word, and you said what is lacking in America today was the communitarian spirit.
Communitarian mm-hmm. spirit, yeah.
And just the delightful interplay, the courtesy, the playfulness, the intellectual understanding and so on between the two of you for the last couple... What time is it, by the way?
It's 1:34.
Oh, my. Well, thanks to Robert Knight for giving you an extra...
Yes, we need to thank him again.
I was up all night last night, and God help me, I have to be all up until 5 tomorrow morning with no sleep so I can catch Bob and then Ibrahim Gonzalez, who were two of my favorite BAI folks.
Yeah.
But anyhow... What a delight. What a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much.
It is so warm. And Margaret, what have you been writing? Did I hear you say the word memoir or something?
No. I wrote a memoir that came out in 1999 called Heretic's Heart, A Journey Through Spirit and Revolution.
Wow. I'm an old pagan gal myself.
Yeah, actually, we should queue up that Dove the Bar at some point.
I was raised up in a...
It's ready.
Born in L.A. and raised in Ojai, California, with, you know, the Ojai Valley, with horses inland from Ventura and Santa Barbara, and, you know...
But actually, if you want to know what I'm working on, although I'm not working that much on it, because, you know, when you have a full-time job as a reporter, it's hard.
Lit major,
but I'm working on a book about vampires, believe it or not.
Oh, shame on you.
No. You want to hear my theory? At some point after the break, I will talk about vampires.
Real quick, my mother was a Romanian Jew, came over, she was 14, came over from Transylvania.
There you go.
So you're going to be
is probably a distant relative on the Gentile side. So I will listen after the break. Go ahead.
Okay. Take care. So I just want to say that the song we're going to play. Yeah. Anyway, goodbye. It was great. The song we're going to play, which you're going to hear, beginning to hear now, is a song I first heard this summer. In October, actually, at a pagan festival. It's a little harsh. It's complicated, but I think it's very meaningful. And it's called The Green and the Gray, and it's by an English singer called Dov the Bard. And it's very pagan.
Father to the man, I have Lucifer, Lucifer, you lie so well. I pray unto my God, now go back to the fires of hell. You fell from heaven, and you fell from grace. You want dominion over this place. The piper smiled, to the priest he said, I was lord of animals, the wild hunt I led. Until your God came here, and with his jealous hand, it was he who wanted dominion over this land. For I'm no devil, I'm father to the land. I have been here since the earth began. Neither black nor white, priest, hear what I say. I'm green and gray. Said all evil comes from your hand. The piper said if evil is, well, it lies in the hearts of man. But you lead us, oh, you tempt us to rape, to steal, to kill. The piper said, whatever happened to free will? Then the grove lay empty, the priest told no one. The blossom lay upon the thorn, and the piper's tune was done. And in the sunlit forest, the animals they bowed, as the piper laid his goddess down. For I'm no devil, I'm father to the land. I have been here since the earth.
Tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf, 40th Anniversary Edition, and we are...
Margo Adler and...
Jim Freund. And we don't know exactly when Hour of the Wolf began. I remember that it was in January.
That's what I remember, too.
Yeah.
It was January.
And I have looked through folios of old. You can go onto the Internet Archive and look at scans of all the folios from years past.
What's the URL for that?
InternetArchive.org.
Really?
Yeah. And it's one of the greatest websites on the Internet.
Wow.
The Internet. Then that includes the Wayback Machine, where you can go and look at the web as it existed on any previous day. You can look at, you know, September 12th, 2001, and see exactly what was on the web that day.
Wow.
And look at a website, even if the website is gone.
InternetArchive.org.
Yeah, or is it actually just archive.org? Let me check right now. It is the Internet Archive, but let's see. Da, da, da. It has a lot of sound. It has a lot of movies.
By the way, while he's looking...
It is just archive.org, actually.
Archive.org.
It is the Internet Archive, but it is archive.org.
And I should just say that anybody who wants to listen to that song again can go to YouTube, and it's on YouTube, Dav the Bard. And he actually spells it. It's odd. He spells it D-A-M-H, but he pronounces it Dav, like David, like Dav the Bard.
Sounds Welsh.
Yeah, I think he's, I don't know what he is.
It's, famous, I mean, the lettering is...
The lettering is very,
sort of Welsh. But anyway, you can look at folios and get a lot of things from the Internet Archive. And in my researches, the first actual mention of Hour of the Wolf in the monthly magazine, the WBAI folio, seems to not be until March.
Mm-hmm.
But it also indicates that the show's been on the air for a while.
Right.
And I remember very clearly that it was in January that it began.
That's what I remember, not clearly, but that's that. If you had asked me when, I would have said January.
Yeah, and I remember because I've always known that January 10th was when WBAI joined Pacifica. People say mistakenly, frequently, that WBAI started on January 10th. No, WBAI began in the 40s. We joined Pacifica January 10th, 1960, and that's a bit of trivia I've always been aware of, and that Hour of the Wolf began approximately then. And so I don't know what day, but I think it was mid-January, and so we are choosing not the date, but the time. It was certainly 40 years ago that Margot began Hour of the Wolf, 5 days a week, 5 to 7 a.m. And was it at the same time, and I think it was a little later, that we then went to weekends as well, 24 hours a day, wasn't it?
You mean the station went?
Yeah.
I'm actually, it's not one of those things I remember.
Yeah, because, you know, eventually Gary Fried began the morning after the night before,
right,
which was 5 to 8:30 a.m.,
mm-hmm,
which then over to, then in about 1979 or 80, Simon Locley took over Saturdays. And then I was moved into the 5 to 7 part of Saturday.
Right.
So, Margot Adler, for those few of you who don't know, aside from work at National Public Radio, is also author of currently two books, Drawing Down the Moon, which is pretty much the definitive book on modern neo-paganism in the U.S., or paganism, and Heretic's Heart, which is a diary of the Berkeley years, and has actually a very lovely opening about Hour of the Wolf. And there's a third book in the works.
Sort of, slowly in the works, yeah. So I have talked about this before on the air. I did talk about it last time I was on, I think.
That's right, which was, as far as we knew, the last episode ever of Hour
of
the Wolf.
Right, but very briefly, it's a very strange story. I mean, I've had a very bad 2 years. I've had a very hard 2 years. For anybody who doesn't know this, the first thing that happened is that my husband of my, he was, well, my partner of 33 years, John Glideman, got stomach cancer, about in May of 2009. And it was, I mean, he was the healthiest man alive. He was, you know, a runner and ate perfectly and, unlike me, never did anything wrong, never smoked, never, you know, never took any drugs, never did any of the 60s things.
Went around the house measuring radiation.
Oh, well, when I was pregnant, he was determined that I, you know, because I was had a miscarriage before, he had one of those radiation detectors and was going to make sure that, you know, he only let me go on the computer to, like, once a day for, like, you know, he had all these, like, regulations. So, I mean, he was a very health conscious, taking supplements kind of guy, exercising, was, you know, in perfect health, et cetera. And suddenly he got terminal stomach cancer, and 9 months later he was dead. So there were 9 really horrible, 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 horrible months when he was sick and I was taking care of him. And then after he died, which was in February of 2010, then like less than a year later, I got endometrial cancer and went through chemo and radiation. I seem to be fine now. But so it was like 2 years of just knock on wood, yes, right. So, you know, it was just two really horrible years, and some other things happened, which I won't go into, but it was just really, really horrible, horrible, horrible. And right at the beginning of my husband's sickness, right actually before, about a week before he was diagnosed, I was at a pagan gathering in Florida called Florida Pagan Gathering, actually. And I was on the plane, and I needed a junky book to read on the plane. And I ended up buying the first Twilight novel. Now, I have to tell you that the only time I had ever, I think I read The Vampire Lestat one, you know, one of Anne Rice's like 20 years ago. I think I read one, I went and saw The Hunger because Whitley Strieber was a friend of mine and thought it was a very seductive and interesting movie. But, you know, I have to tell you that it never occurred to me to be even remotely interested in vampires at all. And I read the first Twilight novel on the plane and I got extremely gripped by it for whatever reason. And it was one of those things, I had never come across this before, but you know, you can go into an airport and you can buy a book, but you can return that book for a certain, you know, there are these things where you buy the book and then you can return it and get the next one and pay much less money or whatever, get half of it back or whatever. So I was, you know, sort of excited about that. So I got the second book and I was reading it, so forth. And then, you know, a week later, my husband got diagnosed with terminal stomach cancer. And I think maybe it was, you know, here I was sitting at his bedside. I took a lot of time off from work. I was only working an average of about 2 days a week for the time that he was sick. And I was sitting by his bedside, and a lot of times he was sleeping. And I guess I was in some way meditating on mortality, too. I was thinking about issues of life and death and so forth. And in that period, I started obsessively reading vampire novels. And so I started out, you know, I read The Twilight and I read all of Charlene Harris. I read Whitley Strieber's three vampire novels. I, you know, read Dracula. I read, you know, I just started going and doing more and more and more and more. And as I said, I wasn't sure why I was doing this. I was really kind of fascinated that I was doing this, but I couldn't figure it out at all. It was like just very, I said, this is the weirdest thing. Why the bleep am I doing this? I mean, this is like really, really weird. And also, I hadn't been reading that much before that. I mean, I was so busy with work and stuff, and here I was suddenly just obsessively reading these books. And I kept on saying, there must be a reason besides, here's what I know. Okay, part of it is a meditation on life and death and mortality issues. That's clearly something that's going on, but it must be more than that. And everybody says this is all about sex, and it's clearly not about sex for me, because sex wasn't really big in my life at that point, and certainly hadn't been for many years. And so I said, so it's not about sex. So something else is going on here. And
it may, by the way, be pointed out, because you're saying it's not about sex. And I was thinking, you know, one of the most fascinating things was on Broadway, the production of Dracula, starring Frank Langella.
Well, yes, that was
which all had been directed by
Dennis Rosa. Dennis Rosa, who was actually my mother had taken him in as a boarder when he was an actor, and then he became a director, and he ended up directing Dracula, and he lived in our apartment and so forth. But you know,
that was considered one of the sexiest productions.
Yes, yeah, but I, you know, and I just I saw it. I saw it, and I wasn't, you know, it was interesting, but it never really did that.
I love the Edward Gorey.
Yeah, the Edward Gorey sets were extraordinary. But, you know, it didn't, it, again, it wasn't really anything that was big for me. So I couldn't figure this all out. So, you know, I'm one of these people who, if you want to figure something out, you go and look at some academics. So I started, like, looking at books that were written about vampires by academics. And there's a book called Are Vampires Ourselves by a feminist author. And there's another interesting book by someone else. And I started reading these academic writers. And I started interviewing some academics as well, because I did decided to do a piece on NPR so I could further interview people and so forth. By this time, I'd read 75 vampire novels by the time I did my piece on NPR. And I was reading every kind of genre. You know, there are detective, vampire novels. There are science fiction vampire novels. There are beautiful literary vampire novels. There are funny, comic, nerdy vampire novels. There's teen romance. There's adult romance. There's porn and near porn. There is just every genre under the sun. And there are really ones that are totally funny. There are ones that are really dark and dystopian and noir. Within the genre, there are probably, 25 different genres, and at least. And some of them are literary and wonderful. And actually, for example, George R.R. Martin, who everybody knows because of Game of Thrones, wrote a book called Fever Dream, which is an extraordinary novel. It takes place on a Mississippi riverboat during that period of time and involves a vampire. But it's just an extraordinary novel. Anyway, I just kept on reading these, and so I was talking to these academics and the one phrase that first blew my mind was, every society creates the vampire it needs. And I started thinking about that really deeply and talking to academics about that, and it became very clear that, for example, to give you three obvious examples, in 1897, when Bram Stoker wrote Dracula, England had the largest ports in the world. There was an incredible fear of disease coming in from foreign parts, a fear of immigration, sort of the first globalization. So, of course, the mythic image of this Eastern European foreigner bringing dirt from a foreign land, perfect, perfect metaphor for the fears and concerns of that moment. 1980s, a lot of books on vampirism as a disease, as the United States was confronting AIDS and so forth and so on. So, I mean, you can go period by period and you can sort of look at this and sort of see what are the fears and concerns of this period and how is the particular wave of vampire interest related to that. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing that happened was, now I'm sort of at about book 125, I end up talking to a woman who teaches vampire film and fiction at the University of the Pacific in California. And she also teaches literature of war and Jane Austen. She's an English professor, but she also teaches this vampires and film course. And she said to me, if you look at all these vampire novels, if you look at the best films, actually, the ones that are really interesting, they're all really about power. She said, they're not about sex. They're really about power. She said, if you think about it, what is the question they're always asking? The question is, should we treat these human beings like cattle because we're superior to them? Or, since we were once human beings, should we treat them as human beings because, we have a moral duty to be whatever it is? And she said, that's not such a different question as, what do we do if we have more money than someone? What do we do if we have more status than someone? What do we do if we have more power than someone? It's not a coincidence that Occupy Wall Street was basically using the vampire motif in some of their costumes and parades and so forth to sort of describe certain Wall Street aspects and so forth. So that was the second thing that came on. But the real insight, the real moment, my sort of epiphany moment was, and by this time I had watched every episode of Buffy, all seven.
Finally, I've been trying to get you to watch that
seven,
for years.
It took me years, right? But seven, I got the seven seasons and I watched every single one
you
of them.
You gobbled them down in like 3 months.
I gobbled them down. Yeah. I gobbled down Angel. I gobbled down the CBS Moonlight series 1 year, which was fabulous. I gobbled down the Tanya Huff Lifetime series, Blood Ties. I just gobbled them all down, right? And I was reading these books. And at one point I said, okay, so we know it's about power and not sex. And we know that every society creates the vampire it needs. But that still doesn't explain to me why I am so totally obsessed. What's going on now? What are our fears and concerns? What is the situation now? So one day I was just sort of sitting there with a pencil and a paper. And I put down all the most interesting, famous vampires of the last 10 years. So I just put them in a row. So I went, okay, We'll get Angel and Spike from Buffy, and we'll get the Cullen family, all of the Cullens, Alice and Edward, and so forth and so on, and the Cullens, we'll put them there. And, of course, there's Bill and Eric from True Blood, and there's Stefan and Damon from The Vampire Diaries, and then there's, let's see, there's Henry Fitzroy from Tanya Huff novels and from the Lifetime series, and... oh, yes, there's Mick St. John from the CBS series Moonlight. And I just put them all in a little row there. And you can add all kinds of other ones if you want. But those were the main ones I did. Oh, I put in, I think, Jessica from True Blood and a couple of other ones. And I said, well, what do they all have in common? And it was at that moment that I had my sort of green ecological planet Earth epiphany. It's all I can call it, you know. In which I said, oh, my God, they're all struggling desperately to be moral despite being predators, every single one of them. And they're often failing, but they're all struggling deeply to be moral despite being predators. And that's exactly who we are right now as we wage these wars, as we suck the lifeblood out of the planet, as oil is our blood to some extent, you know? And we are as addicted to oil as a vampire is addicted to blood. And all of this sort of ecological and planetary stuff kind of started merging. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting. There is something going on here. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but there is clearly something here about this moral struggle. And for me, the books that I liked, and as I said, I've now read 200 vampire novels.
I was wondering when you were going to hit that 200.
It was yesterday.
Oh, so we could be celebrating that as much.
My 200th vampire there you, novel.
Oh, my God.
My 200th vampire
the
novel.
The 200th V.
The 200th V, right, yeah. Exactly. And but I was going to say something about, I was about to, before you interrupted me with that, I actually had an idea that I was actually going to say about that. Let's see. The moral struggle. I was talking about the moral struggle. And I was saying that that really shaped, I really understood also that that's what, oh, I also understood, you can take some that way too. I also understood.
Shut up.
Right. I also understood that the ones I liked and the ones I hated had a lot to do with that question of moral struggle. For instance, there are a number of books that have been on the bestseller list in the last couple of years, in the last year actually, that are probably the most popular vampire novels that I absolutely hated, like The Passage by Cronin, and what I thought I was going to love but hated, the Strain. By Toro.
Really?
Yes, because in both of those cases, and I thought Del Toro, given Pan's Labyrinth and everything like that, this was going to be like a really amazing novel. But I decided that I really don't like horror. I mean, this is a really weird thing to say as a vampire novel obsessionist. I don't like horror, and I don't like vampires who aren't sentient, who are just simply monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And in The Passage and in Del Toro's work in the Strain, they really are not sentient creatures. They become these completely, they just become, monsters who are just out
unthinking
to...
Unthinking
zombies. Unthinking zombie-like monsters, yes, even though they're vampires. And to me, that, of course, that obviates the moral struggle. There's no moral struggle left if you're not a sentient creature. And so for me, the ones that interest me the most are the ones that are struggling with moral decisions every day, of which some of the best novels do that all the time, and some of the best TV shows do that all the time. And so I'm trying to figure out, I have a book proposal, I'm eventually hoping to write a book about this. Unfortunately, in our culture, fiction is what sells in the vampire world, and the idea of doing a non-fiction vampire book is complicated. I mean, there are books that are like encyclopedias that have done well and so forth, and maybe even my annotated, my when it gets to 250, maybe Margot Adler's annotated vampire book list, of which I make a very funny lecture when I talk about some of these books, because some of them are very weird and funny.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there's one that's kind of Gossip Girls plus Vampires, which is a whole series, which is a whole other thing. There are some really, really, and there's some really bad ones, too. too. I mean, if I, some of the romance, some of the sort of adult romance ones have the worst sex scenes I have ever come across. If I hear the phrase one more time, he filled me. Ooh. I'm just, sorry. It's just horrible, you know, just absolutely horrible. And on the other hand, there are really beautiful literary works that are absolutely wonderful. There's, on the weirdest series I've come across is one called Blue Bloods, which is a series of teens, of upscale teens on the east side of New York, the kind that would go to east side private schools. This is the Gossip Girls plus vampires, in which the 400 families that came over on the Mayflower are really, you guessed it, and that's why they're sent. That's why all the moms are social x-rays. They don't even have to eat. I mean, it's the weirdest series you've ever. I think it's by Della Cruz, I think, is her last, but it is one of the weirdest things you have ever seen. And then there are all these not very good series of books, like there's a series, sort of funny novels called Undead and Unwed, Undead and Unemployed, Undead and this, that, and the other. You know, I mean, there's, and then there's, you know, people like Christopher Moore who have some funny ones like Bloodsucking Fiends, A Love Story, and Suck, A Love Story. And there are some extremely, and then there are some really beautiful books. You know, one of the writers that I came across that really, I was shocked because I'd never read anything by her. She was one of these writers that had written 200 books, and it turns out, 250 books, I think, and it turns out that she actually writes them herself. She does not have a stable of writers, and it's Nora Roberts. Mm. And I had never read any of Nora Roberts, and there is a trilogy that she's written called The Circle Trilogy, and it is a mix of science fiction, fantasy. Part of it takes place in modern New York and Chicago. Part of it takes place in ancient Ireland. Part of it takes place in a kind of fantasy realm that is sort of like Ireland, but it's kind of a Celtic realm. And creatures from each of these team up into and they're just one of them happens to be a vampire, but one of them, they're everything else. One of them's a witch, one of them. And it's beautifully written. And even the love interests are beautifully written, subtle, you know, so that you just beautifully done. And this is a woman who's written 250 books, I still can't get over it. You know, I still can't. On the other hand, there are some books that are, I just finished reading 5 books, very quick ones, by YA novels, young adult novels, by Amanda Hocking, who self-published these all by herself on the internet. And because she self-published them, they're called My Blood Approves is the first one, and then there's Fate, My Blood Approves 2, Flutter, My Blood Approves 3, Wisdom, My Blood Approves 4, and then there's a novella at the end. And because she self-published them, there are enormous grammatical errors and typos all over the place, but it's not bad. You know, the plot is not bad, and it's actually, I was gripped. You know, I will say I was gripped. And then there are some really lovely books, like this book that was actually on the bestseller list, the New York Times bestseller list, for at least a couple of weeks this year, called A Discovery of Witches.
Ah, yes. Witches, Deborah Harkness.
Deborah Harkness.
Which
very
you got
good.
Me to read, and I really, I mean, I'm totally annoyed, because how long do we have to wait for the next book now?
I know. It was totally gripping,
it
right?
There was a time in there when I sort of felt, yes, okay, I've gotten past, every time I was about to, I've had enough of the castle in France and I've had enough of this, just at that moment when I was about to tire of it, it switched. It was as if she knew where my interest would flag, and she took us to a new place, and it was so well done, until finally at the end of the book, it takes you to
a totally new place,
promising grand new adventures, and I can't bleeping wait. It was, yeah, I love that book.
And the thing that's wonderful about this book by Deborah Harkness,
The
witches are great, the vampires are great, all the other creatures are great, but it takes place in a scientific realm.
Yes.
The woman who wrote it is a historian of science. She teaches history of science at UCLA or whatever.
There's a lot about wine in that book.
She's also has a blog on wine. But she's also, and the whole book is about a woman who is from a old Salem witch family, but wants nothing to do with it. She wants to be a scientific historian, and she is in Oxford to research that moment in time where chemistry and alchemy split. And she is there basically researching this at the Bodleian Library, and she calls up a book that actually in real life was lost. In fact, this is something like Ashmole 782. I don't remember the number, but it was something like that. And she gets the book, and then she puts the book, she takes some notes, she puts the book back, and unbeknownst to her, this book has been lost for 300 years. No one has found it. And her finding it essentially awakes the underworld or the other world to an extent where suddenly she is a target and all kinds of fascinating things
and
happen.
And nobody and nothing believes it's accidental.
Exactly. It's very...
That she has somehow done this.
But because it's done through this sort of... You're sort of... And even the vampire is a geneticist. So there's this wonderful melding of what I would call sort of, you know, factual scientific reality and this fantasy realm.
But there's also the classic science fiction discovery kind of a thing in which she is so powerful but is unaware
of her powers.
Of her powers, and it turns out that she's, of course, the product of some of the most powerful witches that ever were and is waiting to come into her own.
Which she doesn't want anything to do with. I mean, she's just slowly, she has to be kind of even pulled to even want any of this because she essentially ran away to Oxford to essentially be a scientific
historian. And when she goes,
historian.
By the way, when she goes home to her witchian realm.
Her witch family. Basically her witch family.
Yeah. There's more to it than just being witches. The house itself is a wonderful character. It's really just a thoroughly entertaining, engrossing book, which I did not expect to draw me in, and it totally did. Is it out on paper yet?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Actually, I don't know.
And I have no idea how long it's going to take her to do the second one, but by the time, let's put it this way for you science fiction people, by the time we get to the end of the book, without saying more, time travel does enter into
now
this.
You gave it away.
I didn't say anything more. No. I'm not saying where, when, how, but we know that we are going to start book two in a somewhat different time and place.
Exactly. It's science fiction people should be totally at home with it. Witchy people, vampiric people, whatever. And scientific people. One of my problems with a lot of vampire fiction, and a lot of horror fiction in general is I don't like gore.
Mm-hmm. I don't either.
It kept me, even Terence Taylor's first book, Bite Marks, I had to keep a certain amount of distance from.
I'm going to confess that one of the reasons that I read Amanda Hocking's 5 novels, just slurped them up, is because I was at page 200 finally in Salem's Lot, and I'm too scared to go on.
Wow.
I'm like so scared. I am like, do I really want to read? Do I really want to find out what's going on here? It's like, it was like with The Shining. I don't want to, you know, it's like, well, of course, The Shining was the most scary movie I've ever seen in my life. You know, if you're married to a writer.
The first one, thank
you. You're married to a writer. If you're married to a writer and there's that scene, the scariest scene in the book, in the movie, when she opens the manuscript. And there, written thousands and thousands of times, is all work and no play make Jack a dull boy. Mm-hmm. And that she realizes that's the only thing her husband has been doing instead of writing this book. Mm-hmm. Is the scariest for anybody who is living with a writer, is the scariest moment in the world. But anyway, I agree with you. I don't really like horror. And I don't really like gore. And one of the problems I'm having with True Blood, which I loved, and I loved all the books, is that it, as each season has gone on,
it gets gorier.
It has gotten gorier and gorier and gorier.
I had the problem with Game of Thrones, you know.
I haven't watched that yet, but yeah, I hear it's too gory. Yeah.
And I'm a big George Martin fan. He was a friend of mine when he lived hereabouts, right. and even before he went off to Hollywood, and well, first Chicago and then Hollywood.
So what I've come to, the thing I've come to, which I realize I have to do, and I have avoided this in a big way, is I have to read a bunch of, now that I'm at 200, before I get to 250, I have to read a bunch of the books like Salem's Lot, books that are sort of classics that I've avoided. Yeah. And I have avoided a lot of what I would call the gothic stuff. I mean, I've read Camilla and I've read Dracula and all that kind of stuff, but I have not read 90% of Anne Rice. And I have to do it. Because if I'm going to have at least a somewhat complete, I mean, it won't be complete. There are 5,000 vampire novels.
It's becoming your job,
but
now,
I now
as opposed
feel,
to your avocation.
Now I feel that I at least have to read. I've only read two books by Anne Rice, and one of them was 20 years ago. So I finally bought.
There are other reasons not to read Anne Rice, but.
Well, yeah, but anyway, I finally bought five of them, and so they're on my list. But once I finish Salem's Lot. Let's take some more phone calls. This is WBAI. This is Hour of the Wolf, 99.5. This is Margo Adler and Jim Freund. And we're sitting here talking about all kinds of stuff.
And the phone number is 212-209-2900. And good morning. You are on the radio. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, you were talking about Anne Rice.
Well, we mentioned Anne Rice, yes.
Yeah, something that happened to me. This was back in the 70s. I was sitting in a tavern reading her first novel.
Interview with the Vampire, or which one?
Yes.
Okay.
And somebody who was sitting next to me said that that Anne Rice was a teacher in California.
I don't know about that. She lives in New Orleans.
Yeah, but she was teaching in California. This was in the Pacific Northwest. I was sitting there in a tavern reading the Diary of a Vampire, and she mentioned the fact that Anne Rice had a daughter who had a blood.
Her daughter died, and a lot of people, and a lot of, and there are many people, and I think she herself has said that one of the reasons she wrote a lot of these vampire novels was a meditation, essentially, on the whole question of mortality and immortality, and a lot of it came out of the death of her daughter, and the other thing that is true is that she's had a very interesting religious journey. She wrote all those books, then she became a Christian suddenly, and she wrote all these Christian books, and then she unbecame a Christian, and now she's no longer a Christian, and now she's writing more. And she's had some very interesting spiritual journeys. But yes, her daughter died.
Yeah, I just wanted to point that out because, you know, that stunned me because I was just sitting there reading this novel, and somebody who was a student of hers pointed this out to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you for being there.
All right.
Take care. Have
Bye-bye.
A great morning. And good morning. You're on the radio. Hi there. Turn your radio down.
Hello, WBAI. Hi.
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, it's a pleasure to hear both of you on together. I used to listen to Margo Adler about 30 years ago on Stuck in Time when it was on Sunday.
Right.
So it's a pleasure to hear both of you. I'm just curious, Margo, you're still a pagan, correct?
I still am.
I'm curious, you said you were slightly afraid of you know, the gore of all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But yourself, being a pagan, and I think you had that book years ago where you wrote about your experiences drawing down the moon.
Yes, Drawing Down the Moon is my book on paganism, yes.
I'm curious about that. Also, Octavia Butler was dealing with subjects like this, like what you're talking about.
In her book Fledgling, for example?
Yes.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, Jim and I were having a very long talk about Fledgling over dinner before we came here, yes. But that's a very much of a book I would say that while there is a vampire in that book, a lot of that book is really about prejudice, difference.
The other,
being the other. Very much appropriate for an African-American writer to be writing about.
Okay. So I guess going back with your vampire being whatever the social thing at the moment, you know, being the vehicle for whatever, you know, vampirism of different time periods and different conditions. I'm just curious about both of you, you know, just discussing, you know, extrapolating more on that. And I'll hang up, but it's a pleasure to hear you both at this period of time. I had good experiences listening to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Take care.
And the only thing I would say is that I was interested. I think the question he was trying to ask, and maybe I'm putting words in his mouth, but, you know, he was saying, you know, that I had expressed this feeling about gore, and yet I was a pagan, and nature is sometimes red in tooth and claw to some extent, you know, and there is, it is true that nature is not namby-pamby. Nature can be brutal. Nature can be Hurricane Irene. You know, nature is not, as a matter of fact, that song I play, Green and Gray, it's not black or white. It's green and it's gray. You know, it's that combination. But I think that, and I would say that in True Blood, there is a lot of gore particularly in the last season, and actually in the last two seasons. I think it went slowly more and more and more. The first season is actually my favorite season, which had the least gore in it. But I think that the moral struggle that you see Bill in, that you begin to actually see Eric in, is, you know, they're sort of dealing again with this whole predator thing. And it makes me want to tell a story that has nothing to do with vampires, but that made me realize something very interesting. Actually, I have a button. Who was the guy in True Blood? The wonderful, wonderful. I'm having a senior moment now. The guy who's sort of like, the Dalai Lama. There's this, you know, vampire who basically is so distraught at the way the vampires are behaving, he ends up committing suicide by going into the sun. And I actually have a button that says, the button's about Jesus. What would Jesus do? It's what would this person do? What would I have somewhere? What would whatever his name begins with G? I'm completely having a senior moment here. But anyway, so I think about 20 years ago, probably more than 20 years ago, about 25 years ago, I was sitting around in Washington, D.C., substitute hosting on All Things Considered, or Weekend All Things Considered. And I suddenly was sitting there feeling, it was just very pressured, and I had to do this, I had to do that. And I finally said to myself, well, what would I want to do? If I'm here, substitute hosting, what if I could do anything? What would I do? And I realized that when I was 10, what I really wanted was to have a falcon. I wanted to be a falconer. I had read, you know, The Sword and the Stone. I'd read, you know, The Once and Future King. I'd read even The Gosh Hawk by T.H. White. And I wanted to have a falcon. And of course, I lived in New York City. This was never going to happen, right? So I said, well, maybe I could find a falconer and I could go out and spend some time with a falconer. So I wrote a letter to the American Falconry Association, and I blah blah blah. And they said, "Oh, we know this one person, but his hawks in the east anyway. But his hawks are molting; you can't do that." Anyway, this went on for like 6 months, and finally, someone said, "One of these people said, we have the person for you, and it is Robert Kennedy Jr., the environmental lawyer."
Right.
The one who does all the work on the water and everything like that. He has hawks. And so they put me in touch with Robert Kennedy Jr. And I ended up meeting him, and one thing led to another. I ended up at his house in Mount Kisco, it was, where he had this house. And he had this extraordinary house where he had all these animals. And he had two hawks that were sitting on posts. And he had golden eagles, and he had iguanas. I mean, he had all these incredible animals. And he said, you know, come up for a weekend. You can stay over. And in the morning, we'll go and help band hawks up on this near Bear Mountain. And after that, I'll take you and we can fly our hawks here and you can see how it works. So after we came back, he put the glove on, and I went out with him, and it was like reliving my little teen dream, you know, it was like, my 12-year-old dream or my 10-year-old dream. And I actually, you know, the hawk was flying around, and I put the glove on, and he had some raw chicken, and we called the hawk to us, and he came down and got the chicken and landed on my hand, and it was really exciting. And, afterwards, I tried to interview Bobby Kennedy Jr., right? And he's not, first of all, he has a speech impediment, but he also is not the most, he speaks now quite a lot on environmental issues, but he was not at that moment 25 years ago or whenever it was, he was not that articulate. And when I went home, I realized I did not have on my tape recorder what I needed. And so with my heart in my throat, I called him up and said, you know, I didn't quite get what I needed. And about 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, I went up again and I flew the hawks again. I went flying the hawks with him again. And afterwards, I was desperate to get him to say what I needed him to say for this piece, which ended up being like a 13-minute piece on All Things Considered years ago. And so finally, I'm sitting there with him and I say, so what was it like, you know, why did you want to do this? You know, what was this for you? And he said, well, you know, I was growing up and my uncle was president and I really thought about Camelot and I had this whole notion of Camelot, et cetera. He said, and he started talking about that. But I said, but what did it feel like when you're out with the hawks? What's it like? And he says, I swear to whatever he says, you know, it's like running with a wolf pack, he says. He says it's like running with a wolf pack. He says, you know, you're out in nature, like, you know, et cetera. It's like running with a wolf pack. And I started thinking about the Kennedys and how the Kennedys, in their own way, I mean, there were things that were wonderful about them, but there was something ruthless about the Kennedys, about the Kennedy family. There was something that was like running with a wolf pack, you know? And at the end of the piece, as I'm sitting there saying, how am I going to end my piece? And I have this last quote where he's talking about running in nature and da-da-da-da, and it's like being with the animals, and it's like running with the wolf pack. And I say, I quote the famous quote. I say, it's nature red in tooth and claw. I say, you know, I had these medieval fantasies and they were all so benign and they were all so lovely, you know, but what I realized about the hawks and prey and all of that is that nature is red in tooth and claw.
Wow. Not much to say beyond.
So that's sort of my answer to the gore.
I think we needed a howl there,
I think that's sort of my answer to the gore issue, you know, that on one level I don't like it and I'm afraid of it and this, that, and the other, but it is what nature is. And as a nature religionist, I guess I have to be somewhat at home, you know, with the green and the gray.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the red in the meat, though, that turns me off. And also, it's more disturbing to me knowing that it's fictional, knowing that somebody has devised this gore and this stomach-wrenching material. If it's nature, it doesn't trouble me as much. If it's something that has occurred, if somebody has harmed themselves and there's blood or something like that, that's one thing. But when it's fictional, when somebody has devised that moment that is intended to give me a particular visceral effect, I think there's also an offense that I take at that, saying, you did that to me. It's not just that this is what occurs in nature. This was the devisement of either a writer or a special effects team or something like that. And that's not what I want in terms of my entertainment. So it's one thing, you know, tooth and claw in nature, okay. But blood and gore in fiction, not as good. I think that's my part of my thinking about it.
And I think that when we're talking about movies and television shows, which is what we're a lot of what we're talking about,
yes,
when we talk about True Blood and Game of Thrones and stuff like that, we're also talking that a lot of people are making it gorier and gorier and sexier because they think it sells.
It does sell.
Yeah, and it does to some, you know, it does.
I mean, slasher movies of the 80s, and there's a revivalism of that concept today.
Mm-hmm.
That absolutely sells. I talked to my friends here at WBAI, some of them, Max Schmid, who was telling me about some 3D, you know, gore fest, Valentine's Day. Oh, and then the thing slides down at you in 3D, slicing this and that and burning all over the place. You'd love it, Jim. No.
No way.
Well,
no
he
way.
Knew I didn't love it, which is why he was.
Right.
But that's the very thing, is that to people, to many people, that's comedy.
Yeah, and it's not comedy for me at all. But, yeah, for me, as I said, the moral struggle is, and that's why I will even forgive Stephanie Meyer for a lot because she does the moral struggle.
OMG.
You know, she does the moral struggle in Twilight. And I will forgive some of the bad writing. I will forgive, and I actually think there's a lot more about personal identity than people have talked about. But that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
But I will forgive a lot if that moral struggle exists in a book or in a movie or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I can go along with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is the essence of really great fiction. The moral struggle, we were talking earlier about Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy. One of the great stories of morality, and the deeper you get into it. And the very end, by the way, after you and I saw the movie, in December on my birthday. And now I'm two thirds of the way rereading the Le Carré novel, which is my favorite of his. And I yesterday finished watching the 7-hour Alec Guinness production. That's a book all about morality.
Right. You know, another movie that came out this year that was not a big, 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 big bestseller, but really deals with moral struggle in a way and values in a fabulous way. It's the movie with Helen Mirren called The Debt.
Oh, I had heard of this.
Oh, you can see it on pay-per-view. It's,
uh-huh,
you know, it's fabulous.
Yeah.
It's basically the story of three Mossad agents who are to go into East Germany and essentially kidnap a Nazi doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And things go awry. And as a result of things going awry, they decide to lie about what happened.
Right.
And the entire movie is about the ramifications of that lie.
Mm.
And what it in fact means, not only then, but 20 years later, you know, 25 years,
you know,
years,
you're
et
right,
cetera.
I'd love that. I'd
it's
love to see that.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I would love to see that. Especially after investigating this whole thing. And you have to either reread or I'll get you a copy of the Alec Guinness Tinker
Yeah,
Taylor.
I'd love to see that.
Because
yes. It
goes so deeply. You know, the bad guy, the tailor, who is the mole in Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, he becomes that for moral reasons. It's not just... It's this whole thing, this fascinating thing, and East versus West and what the difference is. And it examines the morality of the mole a great deal. So it's a fascinating story and a fascinating thing.
But we should go back and take some more phone
calls. We absolutely should at 212-209-2900 over WBAI New York on Hour of the Wolf with Margot Adler and Jim Freund. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Yes. Hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good morning. Let me turn my radio down.
Okay. Very good. Yeah, well, we're waiting.
Hello. Thank you.
We're here.
First of all, congratulations to both of you on the anniversary.
Thank you.
Jim Freund and Margot Adler. Within the realm of your having given us permission, we the listeners, to get off topic, I want to present just briefly a diverse idea. It's not an idea, it's a question, actually. Could you be so kind as to give an update on Gary Fried at a given point? I just stopped hearing about him.
Gary died of AIDS in the early 80s.
Oh, gee whiz.
He was one of the first AIDS victims I knew.
Oh, was that in the 80s?
Yes, it certainly was.
Oh, wow.
He died of the condition before it had the name.
Before what?
Before it was called AIDS.
Oh, before it was called AIDS.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
It was horrific. He was one of my best friends. He was Margot and John, Margot's husband, and Gary and I went to see Star Wars, the very first screening of Star Wars together, the four of us. I mean, these were special people.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Gary had left WBAI to go to, he was working for a publisher for a while, but then he went to Corpus Christi, Texas, where he became a DJ, where he was actually hoping to come back to New York to get a job as a DJ, because it was easier to get a job as an out-of-towner.
Of course, yeah.
Than it was to actually be hired off of WBAI. And it was while he was down there that he was diagnosed with AIDS, and he had moved out just recently. He had just moved to California, where he was working for a publishing company, a major publishing company, and was hoping to do some DJ work there when he was diagnosed and died.
Sorry to hear that.
It was devastating.
Yeah, he was one of the people I considered to be one of the most talented in radio.
I would agree. In terms of music radio, he was there. There's never been anybody like him.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you very much for calling. I'm sorry to give you this news.
Well, he's at peace, and I'm glad to that you're having the 40th anniversary, and that I've experienced everything, including the memories going back to the late 60s.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care. Good morning. And hi there, you're on the radio.
Hi. I have three things. For one thing, well, four considering congratulations. But one thing, Margot, about the bathrooms, as people get older, it's not that great to have to wait for a bathroom. And if you have a teenage daughter, she may also have a lot of time she has to spend or wishes to spend in the bathroom. And so you don't want to be banging on the door. It's just like not that wonderful. So, you know, that's one thing. But I mean, I have had children, two in a one bathroom apartment where, you know, if I'm in the bathtub, I can just pull the curtain and, you know, they can continue with whatever they're doing. But, you know, these days, if you can get a place with two bathrooms, that really helps. Another thing is,
these people had two and they needed a third.
Well, okay. Yeah. Third for two kids and themselves. Well, whatever. Then the next thing is, Jim, I'm right with you about when people make up gory stuff, even if somebody's telling a gory story. Now, I will go to anybody's hospital. I will run over if somebody's hurt. I will go over, you know, I'll do anything to real-life problems. Do not bother me. But somebody just trying to make a horrible thing or draw a horrible picture and things like that, I don't really go for.
Mm.
And, Margo, you said right before you had all your horrible 2 years, you had been to this this conference, and do you think somebody could have thrown you something?
Which conference? Wait a minute. What do you mean?
You said right before you had all your problems with your previously healthy husband.
Well, my husband was not at the conference.
No, I know, but you said right before that you had gone to this conference down in Florida or something.
Uh-huh.
And then right after that, you got your books and all this trouble started. Have you ever been in a bunch of people where you had the feeling that somebody threw you something? No, I didn't
feel that, no.
Okay.
No. And I'm very resistant. And remember, it was my husband who got it, not me.
Right, but then you got it.
That was a year later.
Endometrial, okay.
A year later. And
I hope everything goes wonderfully for you from
right
now on.
I don't think, and if I got it, I don't think it's because someone threw something at me. I
uh-huh.
think that probably it was, honestly, it was probably years of obesity, which I am no longer. But I mean, you know, when you spend 30 years at, or 20 years or 25 years or whatever, at 200 pounds, there's more estrogen and there's more possibility for a lot of stuff.
Right, true.
So that's probably what went on for me. For my husband, I have no idea. There was nothing. It was just, you know.
He was a runner. He was
like Mr. Perfect Health, you know. I mean, it's nothing genetic, nothing. I mean, just complete out of the blue. For me, I messed my, you know, I was not the best care of myself for many, 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 many
decades. And now you're scaring me because I'm so overweight.
Right, right.
Although, 8 years and 3 weeks since I've had a cigarette. So.
Well, that's very good. Very good.
Oh, that's good. And then when I heard that gray and green, it seemed like the green of the earth and the gray of the water, the oceans, you know. It's very lovely.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much. Nice to hear you all.
Thanks so much. Right. Take care. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hi there.
Are you there?
Nope. Hung up. Okay. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Margo.
Hi there.
Margo, it was good to touch base with you. I met you at Lenny Lopez's party this summer.
Oh, yes. Were you? You weren't the photographer.
No, no. I was with the beard.
Ah, okay.
Okay, so listening to your musings, a couple of ideas crossed my mind I thought I would share with you. First of all, the idea that oil is the new blood makes me think that we're all types of vampires now.
Yep.
The tentative title for my book are Vampires Are Us.
Right. Well,
it's a metaphor that works very well when you think of how oil is in the veins of the earth and all that.
Well, it's in us, too, with all these plastic products that are, you know, the BPA and all this styrofoam and all the stuff that's entering our bodies. But here's the follow-up to that thought. Vis-a-vis the sluggishness of your book production, I think you should open up a blog, vampire blog, and I think that the inspiration of a worldwide sharing, collaboration, will close the circle on your particular book.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting, actually, and that's very possible. That's a very good idea. It has to be, I have to have a little more freedom of time than I have right now, which is one of the problems.
Well, time is always the issue, but you really need, and you know, you can get an intern or two. It's very interesting, and it's, you know, the editing and.
Right.
I had
two offers, one of which just wasn't, you know, one of which was. Financially untenable, but the other one, which would have been okay, was was an imprint of Simon & Schuster, but they kept on saying things like, well, could you write it like Malcolm Gladwell? And I said, well, I'm not Malcolm Gladwell. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
But something will happen.
I think something will happen, but I'm not pushing it too fast because I still have to work out, I have to figure out my future with NPR and how much time I want to spend with them and, you know, there's a lot.
Because it takes,
you know,
time to write.
One of the problems that I've found, this is, you know, I'm always amazed at these people who can get up at 6 in the morning and write for 3 hours and then go to work or whatever. But I have found that the head, the brain space that, how would I put this, that what you need to be a news reporter and what you need to be a writer are completely different. And that the kind of philosophic reflection that you need to be a writer, at least for me, is the kind that needs to turn off the news head, turn off the phone, turn off all that stuff. And when I'm, you know, when I'm in my news head, you know, I'm up in the morning at 5 o'clock, I'm listening to Morning Edition, I'm running around, I'm looking on the internet, et cetera. It's not what I would call the reflective head that I need to write. And so when I did Drawing Down the Moon, I took 3 years off. I was on unemployment, I was this, that, and the other. I was, you know, I was just working as an announcer for a while because basically I didn't have to think, you know, that much. When I did Heretic's Heart, I took a year off. So I do not think that I can write this book while being a reporter. And that's just me.
Or a blog. It's the same kind of a thing. Doing a blog and being a reporter at the same time, I would think would be antithetical.
The other problem is this is a whole other can of worms, is you have to be willing, when you do a blog, at least if you're going to be really honest, the way I've been honest on this program, you're going to veer into areas that you can't veer into if you're a reporter for NPR. Let's put it that way.
Right, I realize that. Margo, I was thinking the blog would be yours inspirationally, but then I imagined it would be in a collection, an assemblage of a worldwide output.
Ah, input. You mean input from everybody about this issue and exactly. How to think about it. That would be interesting. That would actually be interesting.
And that's something that as somebody who's going to try to help Margo find an online place, we can talk about.
Right. Thank you so much for calling.
Okay, Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
Happy New Year. And good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, Margo Adler, and good morning, Jim Freund.
Good morning, Bobson. How are you?
I'm from Bulgaria. Oh, I'm enjoying the three-hour-long Hour of the Wolf, and just congratulations on the 40th anniversary.
Thank you.
Thank you. So you're calling from Bulgaria?
Yeah, same person who called 14 months ago, yes.
I wanted to mention that your show today started 45 minutes before sunrise in this time zone, and it's already light outside.
We achieved, as Bobson said to me, and said to us, in fact, on that last properly timed Hour of the Wolf, it's always the Hour of the Wolf somewhere.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think I'm going to get to Bulgaria, but I have been invited to be a keynote speaker in Transylvania in October. Not on vampires, but it just so happens.
Well, I'm looking forward to your book when it comes out. It sounds really interesting what you have been working on. And you mentioned Fever Dream, and I only recently came across the book in a bookstore, and I thought, George R. R. Martin, it's not one of the Ice and Snow books. Interesting.
No, I
got it, and I read it, and I enjoyed it very much, and it's...
I also, by the way, highly recommend George's science fiction, Night Flyers, and his Wild Card books. I happen to prefer his science fiction writing over his fantasy writing.
I know of the Wild Card books, but they're kind of, I would like to start with with the first one, and there's three editions by now, or two.
Start with a short story. He has a short story called With Morning Comes Mistfall, which is just one of the best science fiction
stories. Anyhow, I enjoyed Fever Dream when I read it recently, and it, one of the things I enjoyed is not having to wonder how many more books of this there are. are they all done with, or are there going to be...
No, there's still more. There's still more in Fire and Ice.
Which I, after the TV show, I'm not so much...
I think there's two more Fire and Ice books.
Can you get Game of Thrones in Bulgaria?
Well, what you mean the TV show?
Yeah.
Well, I've watched the first. They're showing it in the local HBO, but I've watched the first few episodes and I didn't like it.
Yeah, I haven't watched it. I confess, I have not watched it.
It's not worth anyone's time from what I've seen last year.
But don't take my recommendations. I've been watching The Vampire Diaries on CW, so you know that's...
This one, actually, I've watched the first few episodes, and it wasn't bad.
No.
It wasn't...
Lots stupid, of beheadings. Lots of on-screen beheadings. Never do it for me.
The what?
Lots of beheadings, he said. You know, people off with their heads.
Well, not into... I don't remember any... Beheadings in the diaries.
Oh, he's talking about the Vampire Diaries.
I was talking about
Game of Thrones. I actually enjoy the Vampire Diaries. I love the historical parts, and it's kind of interesting.
Well, I didn't watch much of it, but the early episodes,
they weren't bad. And they're both very cute, the guys. Oh, are they cute, I have to say.
Well, next year, Dark Shadows, the movie. Johnny Depp.
Maybe. I think I've heard about it, but I'm not sure. So I've been enjoying the show, and the 3 hours is not too bad, and it's nice of Mr. Knight to...
It's very nice of him to do that. Yes, I thoroughly agree. I've always said, and I'm not saying this for any purpose, but I've always said that 3 hours is, well, let's put it this way. I thought Hour of the Wolf at 2 hours was too short.
Well,
I thought it was an hour too short.
Right.
I like 3 hours. I did 5 hours for a number of years.
Well,
I like
once
three.
A week, three is quite good. When
yes,
you're doing
exactly.
it every day.
Oh, no. Yes, absolutely. No.
Ever,
but,
ever.
But on as a weekly show, 3 hours is...
Right.
So, very
anyway,
good.
Thank you for calling.
And thank you for a great show that's been going on for a while, and I hope it goes on for quite a while more.
Likewise.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Have a great morning.
You too. Let's see if we can sneak in one more call. Good morning. You're on the air.
Did you mention the Griffiths yet, Margo?
No, I'm not going to mention the Griffiths.
You're not going to mention them?
No.
Oh.
Okay. I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Okay. And so they weren't. Well, let's see. I mean, we have, good Lord, 5 minutes. 5 minutes left. Exactly.
Well, I should say what the Griffiths are, since he brought it up.
Since there's this can of worms lying on the floor,
squiggling
around.
So, among the freebie books that suddenly arrived in my office, freebie vampire books, was a new series called Vampire Empire. And it's basically written by Clay and Susan Griffith. And they started by, the first book was called The Grey Friar. And it's really, it's kind of a combination of fantasy, steampunk, and vampire novel. But the vampires are very different than sort of, it's a very different kind of.
And a certain amount of Scarlet Pimpernel kind of.
Yes, exactly. But a lot of steampunk sort of airships, which do this weird stuff and very steampunky in its atmosphere. The Greyfriar is very, very well written, very beautifully written. And then they have a second book that's out called Riftwalker. That's the second book. And there will be more. And
it's October.
And basically, Jim, in his science fiction review that he does once a month at the Soho Gallery of Digital Arts, we had the Griffiths as guests, and I moderated it. And it was really a pleasure meeting them, and they were great.
They're wonderful people. They really are.
They were really great people, yeah.
Yeah, and we broadcast it, including a portion of your...
My little vamp talk.
Your little vamp talk.
Right.
Yeah, itemizing all the different subcategories. Subcategories,
Right.
I wasn't even sure what Robert was referring to there offhand.
Oh, I'm sure was he just yeah. that. He just was mentioning, yeah.
Yeah. Next New York Review of Science Fiction readings, by the way, Coast Guard. An all Coast Guard reading and Coast Guard.
What does that mean?
For example, next week on this show, Mike Cole will be my guest, and he has sorcerers and sorceresses aboard Coast Guard cutters in the first of his new series of books. So he is active in the service. Actually, he is a current lieutenant in the Coast Guard, and Robert J. Howe, a fine, fine writer, in Terrence Taylor's Writers Group, as a matter of fact, is a former Coast Guard officer, will be the other reader. So we'll have two Coast Guard readers at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
Wow.
And something very exciting in March, and I can't talk about it yet because it's not finalized. And April will be Alaya Dawn Johnson, because her next vampire book is coming out about then, the sequel to Moonshine.
Moonshine, which is one of the 200 books.
And that's right. And E.C. Myers, whose first novel is coming out from Pyre Books, as a matter of fact, same publisher as the Griffiths book. So...
Right.
Those are the next few New York Review of Science Fiction readings.
So here's the interesting question. Do you think that when I retire, who knows when I will retire?
40 years.
What? When I retire, what? From let's say, you know, when I'm 70, it's only 4.5 years away.
I said 40, but have it your way.
40 what?
Yeah, that you'll retire in 40 years.
Oh, in 40 years. Oh.
At least from NPR.
I don't know. I'm actually looking to make a different relationship, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
I want more time to write and lecture and talk and do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Co-host Hour of the Wolf, things like that.
Well, I was just wondering, you know, it would be fun to do another live show on BAI at some point.
Well, yes, it would.
Wouldn't it?
Well, you know, let's...
but not yet. Not while I have this other job. That's the problem, you know.
From your lips to whoever our program director's ears, whether it's Tony Bates or... we'll have a new program director or confirm our interim program director within the month, from what I understand. So then all of our fates will be cast and learned in but that time. But
well, it's been a pleasure, and I guess we should think about what kind of wonderful music are we going out with.
Well, Sales of Silver.
Oh, Sales
Steel
of
I Span.
Yeah,
we,
course,
you know, we
right,
have
right,
to have
right, right.
something representative of Steel I Span.
That's true.
And
they
Sales
were a big,
of Silver.
A big factor in our
They really were in our lives in that era as well.
What's with them these days? Are they still around?
They are still around. They did their 40th anniversary tour not that long ago, as a matter of fact, at a B.B. King's club. And I had Mattie Pryor on the show. And Tim Hart just died at that time. He died just about a year ago of one of the original band members. But they are... putting out new stuff. They're doing both solo and collective work. There's a new Steel Eye album in the works. So this is, of course, from their 1980 album, title song from Sales of Silver, which since 1980 has served as the outro theme for this show. Lister likes it.
Yes,
because he segues with Burn Baby Burn Clappers just perfectly. And that's coming your way. Margot, thank you.
Thank you, Jim. It was fun.
Yeah, so...
I can't believe that I actually stayed up this whole time, since I usually go to bed at 11.
Yeah, but the adrenaline starts going, and the radio, it's addictive.
It is.
Thank you so much.
Yes, it's been great.
Okay, take care.
Thank you. 40 years.
Thank you. Indeed. Yay. And I'll be back next week with the aforementioned Mike Cole. So stay tuned for the 41st year of Hour of the Wolf and the umpteenth year of the 52nd year of WBAI. So good morning, and again, thanks for listening.
find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit. Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
Nine to Nine Single List Alive right here in Burn Baby Burn on a Thursday, which is your Friday, which is your Saturday, which is your Sunday. Nine to Nine Single, y'all.
I'm taking action on the system, thinking they slick, contradicting their own, who's taking me for a fool. They sent my man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game, well I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you, I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire, my desire to burn. What? Betty Ross soda. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother. Gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
And you're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.FM, around the world right here. Burn, baby, burn. Brand new music on WBAI for the first time, y'all. So we do it every Thursday, 212-209-2900, right here. We'll burn the American flag to ashes before Esther comes in here, yeah? Brand new music, yeah.
Well, hot. Tough like crack, walk with your boots by the pack. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Hot, y'all no play that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Me no loose, y'all a boy if you know that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Hot, y'all no play that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Me no loose, y'all. Loose, me ready fi hop on pan it like a rabbit. Fi your rabbit and knock it like a lizard. Me a lap it. If you no have it, rubbers in your pocket. Cancel the ride like a traffic. Me a stop it. AIDS will never heal up. Me no mask it off in a boy come breed up. Love it when you touch up me body and squeeze up. Boy, you better come a war with a shield up. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Hot, y'all no play that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Me no loose, y'all a boy fi know that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Hot, y'all no play that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Me no loose, y'all.
From the top.
Oh my God.
The very last drop.
Like, you want me to go to bed with you with no protection? Ew!
Lick it.
You know it's baby Tosh. Baby, sit my good like that. Give me everything if you could like that. Crack well hot, that tough like crack. Walk with your boots by the park. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Hot, y'all no play that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Me no loose, y'all a boy fi know that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Hot, y'all no play that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Me no loose, y'all loose. Me ready fi hop on pan it like a rabbit. Fi your rabbit and knock it like a lizard. Me a lap it. If you no have it, rubbers in your pocket. Cancel the ride like a traffic. Me a stop it. AIDS will never heal up. Me no mask it off in a boy come breed up. Love it when you touch up me body and squeeze up. Boy, you better come a war with a shield up. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Hot, y'all no play that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. Me no loose, y'all a boy if you know that. Me, nah, ride no beer back. hot girl no play that me. Nah, ride no beer, but me no lose, girl. Me ready for sheer, long time. Him a swear one ear, him fi pop out me here. So me link him up fi come rock out the chair. Rip out the middle page like book leaf at here. Me say, baby cruise it in right there. The boy same don't wear boots like Nike here. Me say, youth, better you move from right here. A good that you a bring the package this year. Because me, nah, ride no beer back. I can't no play that me. Nah, ride no beer back. Me no lose, y'all a boy fi know that me. Nah, ride no beer back. I can't no play that me. Nah, ride no beer back. Me no lose, y'all. Ready fi hop on it like a rabbit. Fi a rabbit and knock it like a lizard. Me a lap it. If you no have it, rubbers in your pocket. Cancel the ride like a traffic. Me a stop it. AIDS will never heal up. Me no mask it off in a boy come breed up. Love it when you touch up me body and squeeze up. Boy, you better come a war with a shield.
Like you should know.
Me, nah, ride no beer back. At y'all no play that me. Nah, ride no beer back. Me no lose, y'all a boy fi know that me. Nah, ride no beer back. I can't no play that me. Nah, ride no beer back. Me no lose, y'all. Lose, y'all.
Always use a condom. McCarthy said, oh,
infama figet. Maganat. Rapist figet. Maganat. Talk about you, I go kill somebody and hurt somebody. Do it now. Miss a man and stop chat. Infama figet. Maganat. Rapist figet. Maganat. Talk about you, I go kill somebody and hurt somebody. Do it now. Miss a man and stop chat. Me no like none of them boy, because none of them don't like me. Because if on them that me make it on them sister me, I get the plus on me, I fuck them wifey. Yeah. Me no like none of them boy, because none of them don't like me. Because if on them that me get the plus them sister me, I make it on me, I fuck them wifey. Alright, Guinness, he's up.